I would like to address the rumours of a certain meeting where a bag of cocaine was found before Emmanuel Macron, the Prime Minister of France, hid it in his pocket. Yes, we all did cocaine that day. And yes, we had a naked dance-off afterwards. This is how we do it in Europe. We like to sniff a little bit of cocaine and then we just get naked and dance and rub up against each other and ish like that. It's fun and we're all gay, so it's perfectly fine. Anyway, thank you and have a nice day.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Bilderberg 2025, not the BCFM politics show. On the 13th, Friday the 13th of June. Well, look, the Friday the 13th myth, I don't know how many times I've said it now, but it is all to do with the arrest of the Knights Templar on 13th of October. Martin, what was it? 13th of October 1307, was it? You were there, come on, admit it, you were there. And the arrest of the Templars was a fantastic thing, it was a brilliant thing. But you see, it's been put out in our so-called history as a terrible thing. Oh no, isn't it dreadful? No, it was fantastic. Because these total satanic maniacs under the guise of the Catholic Church and the Vatican, they were going around killing everyone. They were basically a completely fanatical religious cult, rather like the Zionists, funnily enough, eh? And when they were all arrested, it was a wonderful day. So, like I say, Friday the 13th today is a wonderful day. We're streaming live from a corner of Freedom close by Bristol City Centre. And by the way, don't believe anything we say, as we do our best to share a few flashes of clarity from Bristol's Templar port turned merchant venturer fortress in Tampon Charlie's empire of lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or the Apple App Store, but not the evil Google Play. Easiest place to download the app, which is the easiest way to listen to the programme, and download and listen to the longer interviews too, is on the show page, thisweek.org.uk, just below the big green square download button. Anyway, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust psyops, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, and boring us to tears with irrelevant distraction. Quite a nice little tool, wasn't it, that they invented there. The puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the bankster rentiers. World War III and wage slavery, which we'll be hearing quite a bit about this evening. The wage slavery, particularly for those with eyes to see and ears to hear. The so-called solutions to the multiplying crises. Gaza, Ukraine are just the latest ones. Iran, of course, today. COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate. The twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies are crafted to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist Dark Enlightenment cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their AI, or preferably dead. Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King and vampire queen Carmilla wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they seem interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves, with the help, like during the jabs, of a doctor. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? As we learn, you learn. Helping us, now that's the way the media is supposed to work, didn't you know that, Mr. Peston? Helping us to navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week we'll be looking at why Bristol City Council has given up the idea of housing people. Well, it's got like sort of various things to do with tourism and lots of spending on sort of little projects like resilience. There's loads of money going to net zero, that sort of thing, but not housing people. And we'll be hearing all about that in a minute. Also, we'll be looking at Reeves' spending review. Also, the threat yesterday announced to dissolve the Knesset. Did you know about that? I think actually it was Wednesday evening that news came out, hardly reported here. So Netanyahu about to potentially be deselected and booted out. Oh dear, what a pity for him. Maybe he'll go straight to jail, go directly to jail. And the UN also yesterday evening, Thursday evening, voted for immediate Gaza ceasefire, including the Brits voting for the ceasefire, amazingly. And Bilderberg 2025 convening in Stockholm yesterday. We'll be hoping to go live to Stockholm to speak about that a bit later on. And also, of course, not to mention the nuclear-armed doomsday cult, a certain one which shall not be mentioned, tries to start a war with Iran. We also hear from a local claimant, Sally Roberts. We've got a thing on the spending review with the wonderful Steve Hall, out Martining Martin even sometimes, with his analysis of economics, plus a bit on Russia and the spending review with Chris Williamson, from both of those two from the Workers' Party. Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia and from PRSC by the Trans Lobby. A little extra thing tonight I've managed to winkle out. It's something to do with the burning, the connection between, which nobody knows about, as far as I know, nobody, which is the connection between, if you do, you can say, I know about that, but I bet you don't. It's the connection between the burning down in 1936 of the Crystal Palace and the Great Exhibition in South London and the invention of television and the rivalry between Marconi, EMI and Baird, because Baird's studios were sitting in there, and Baird himself had some interesting things to say about that fire. At the time, the BBC were competing, the two different systems, deciding which one to use. And oh dear, Alexander Palace and the Baird Studios all burnt down. And so they went for the Marconi EMI systems. Isn't that funny? So, Martin, I suppose the obvious thing to start with this week is just cost of living crisis. Where are we at with the spending review? Have the Labour Party actually done anything left-wing?
Well, they've done more left-wing things than the Tories would do, but that's not saying much, is it? Let's face it. All that's happened is that she's saying what she wants to spend money on and roughly where she's going to get it from.
But she's spending money on the health.
She's going to be able to get any
on the NHS. She's saying she's spending a lot more on the NHS. And it does look like she is. But if you look at the fine print, a lot of this is going towards something called NHS Digital.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, this is Wes Streeting, who's actually at Bilderberg, I see.
Yes, he is, yeah.
He, of course, he said, we're going to spend more money on the NHS, but there will have to be reform. A horrendous word, because what reform usually means is marketisation,
top-down
digitalisation. Yeah. The whole thing is that we're going to be using, we're not going to be having human doctors anymore, we're going to be using AI and all this stuff. And so, you know, it's like a curate's egg.
Well, somebody is saying, aren't they, that by digitising a lot of these things, we'll save a fantastic amount of money and get those waiting lists down.
Well, in theory, yes, but in practice, it's actually just digitalisation for the sake of it. And, of course, the quid pro quo for spending more money on the NHS, the real masters of the universe, people like Peter Thiel, they are happy for the government to spend money on things like healthcare in a country like Britain, as long as they get a big fat chunk of it. And that, of course, is the way we're going. So even though we're spending more money on the health service than would have been done under the Tories, the whole marketisation agenda continues in a disguised form, as it has done for decades.
Well, another thing that Rachel Reeves has said she's doing in this spending review is giving a lot of money to both social and affordable housing.
Well, that's an admirable goal, but what does it actually boil down to in practice? And the reality is, as we said last week on this show or the week before, any council housing that you build has got to be sold off to the tenants. So there's no point building council housing. You could change the rules about that, but they're not going to. So social housing means housing through housing associations, which are quasi-private bodies. So again, we're going to spend more money on this, but it's got to be channeled through the right sources, which means, of course, that we're moving to step-by-step to marketisation of the whole society.
Now, I was looking at the news last week, and there was it was about 50 or 60 houses in a large housing scheme, a mixture of detached and semi-detached, so-called affordable housing. The company that built them has gone bust, and no one wants to buy them at the prices that they're slated to sell for. So the bank is now considering renting them.
Well, I mean, that's what happened, if you remember, during the 2008 crisis. We had the councillor, Lib Dem councillor, who used to be for, you know, the area around the docks. And, of course, a lot of these posh houses that they built, they couldn't sell. And so, they became social housing. And so, don't forget, house prices have started to dip in this country.
Affordable or social? Big, big difference.
Well, I mean, affordable, what does affordable mean?
Well, it means
it doesn't mean affordable
afford
to
it.
The people sleeping
it's
in
so,
the streets out
in
here.
In fact, in this case, it's so unaffordable that no one can afford to buy it and they have to rent it from the bank.
Well, there you are. So, in other words, this term affordable just, it's not proper council housing, which is designed for low-income people. It isn't.
Anyway, we have a large itinerant population here in the West Country, and many of the people have traditionally spent the winter here in Bristol in caravans and mobile homes, etc. Some of them absolutely beautiful, really beautifully looked after, carved, sort of wooden places with, one or two rooms inside. Some even of the coaches have got several rooms inside them, bedroom and a lounge, etc., etc. Some of them are fantastic looking. But the fact is, we've now got between 600 and 700 people now living in caravans and mobile homes here in Bristol, Martin. Do you think the spending review has done anything for those homeless people? The council estimate, because they don't actually keep proper numbers anymore. They keep just bringing the list down because they know they can't house the people. So we reckon at least 15,000 people on the housing list just here in Bristol.
Well, it's not going to do anything, is it? It's tinkering, basically.
And most of these people who are up on the downs one way or another have been cut off of benefit, housing benefit, universal credit, whatever.
Well, living on the bottom rungs of our society has never been tougher. And the problem with Bristol is it's quite a successful city in terms of turnover and business rate, profitability and so on. But of course, that means it's very difficult if you've got very low income because of the housing costs.
The other thing is, if you've got a medium income, by living in a mobile home or a caravan, at least you can save up a deposit.
Well, of course, people are adopting all sorts of strategies, tactics to try and deal with the circumstances in which they find themselves. But of course, this crisis has been building for years and years and years, and we're now reaching, the terminal stages of it where, I mean, what's happened in London, for example, which is up further down the road than we are, is that the primary schools are all closing because local people can't afford, even though if they've lived there for generations, they can't afford to live in London. So they're leaving. And London is going to be for wealthy people from abroad. And that's, Bristol is not as far down the road as that, but that's where we're going.
Oh, they are shipping people out to Newport, aren't they?
Well, that's right. And of course, this is the housing bubbles in this country, which we've had, are incredibly pointless and destructive. It puts lots of money in the pockets of developers, speculators, estate agents. There's a huge kind of gravy train of people who are making money out of it. But of course, apart from the wretched unfairness of it all, it actually cripples the economy. It's the property bubbles in Britain which have deindustrialised
the
economy.
Well, that's true, yeah, because of the massive amount of money you've got to pay people. It's not helped by the increase in national insurance. So, I mean, I put it to you that actually what Rachel Reeves has been doing is no different whatsoever from what the Tories have been doing.
Now, it's a bit different. It's not as extreme as what the Tories would have done, but it's on the same lines. What they're doing is we can manage capitalism more effectively than the Tories. Look at Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng. Yeah. They didn't understand what they were doing. They just crashed the car. We're not going to crash the car, but obviously we can't do very much. And, of course, this is the standard line of Labour governments. Yeah. We'd like to help, but we haven't got any money.
The country's in a debt trap, and the people it's borrowed money from are now dictating the policy.
Well, that's always been true, Tony. What we could do is completely change the way money's created.
It's not. It's always been a tug of war.
Who's going to do that?
So, for example, when Gordon Brown became Prime Minister, the first thing he did was to relinquish any power over controlling the Bank of England, the governor of the Bank of England. So he just decided, no, we're not going to bother. We're doing that anymore. So that's another reason why, slowly but surely, the people that have lent the government money are really in the driving seat. Look, let's just talk about the Downs for a minute, though, with all the caravans up there, because this is a very posh area. £1 million houses surround the Downs, and now we've got several hundred people living up there. So on Thursday, that's last night, there was a march by the locals, and I'm pleased to say that it wasn't just a sort of anti-traveller march. The focus of the march was on Bristol City Council saying, why are you doing absolutely nothing? You don't even know who's up here, and you've got absolutely no plan to deal with it.
Good evening. First tonight, hundreds of people are expected to gather on Bristol Downs later to protest at what they say is the council's failure to protect the valuable green space. In recent months, the number of people living in vans and caravans around the Downs has increased significantly.
Campaigners say this puts pedestrians at risk and is damaging to the environment. Well, Karen Bell is there for us now. Karen, this issue really seems to have escalated over the past year. What's behind that?
Well, quite simply, Ellie, because the number of people living in caravans across Bristol has quadrupled in 5 years. There's an estimated 800 plus people now living in caravans permanently. And tonight, as you say, there is going to be a march on the Downs by concerned residents who want these caravans removed. The leader of the organisation behind that march called Protect the Downs is with me now, Tony Nelson. Tony, thanks for joining us. If we were to ask the van dwellers, as they've been termed, why they're here, they'd say there's a housing crisis, rents have spiralled, they've nowhere else to live.
Now, this isn't a binary issue. There are lots of different factions within the van dwelling community. There are a lot of people who are truly homeless, but we know from our recent Freedom of Information request, the council aren't speaking to them. They don't know how many vans are here. They haven't counted them. They don't know how many are occupied because they haven't counted them. And if they had, I doubt very much they'd actually know how many people were eligible for real council support. Get them on the housing waiting list. Look for meanwhile sites to put them in. But the council aren't looking after the people who really need help.
Meanwhile site. So that is the council's medium-term solution, isn't it? A sort of temporary serviced place with water, sewerage, where these caravans could go. Do you like that idea?
Yeah, meanwhile sites, if the council got them up and running, it's a perfectly valid idea. And that's actually, you know, the standard answer to these sort of things. You speak to some of the van dwellers and they say they're not nice places. You're going to go live in our parks? I fancy going camping this weekend to Hyde Park, you know, and take my kids there. But we all know what would happen when I rock up there in my car and tent. I'll be moved straight off. You know, these are parks relied on. This in particular is owned by the people of Bristol. It's not owned by a few people who want to come and live here. And if the council actually found the truly homeless, they could give them the support.
I'm going to have to stop you, Tate. We could go on all evening about this. There's very strong feelings on both sides. The march tonight.
So it was a sort of, it was more of a sort of gaggle of several hundred people wandering around the Downs and just really sort of networking and chit-chatting with each other. And there are actually quite a few of the people who live in the vans were walking along with them. But Martin, both you and I were chuckling there when Nelson there was trying to say, well, the council should just put them on their housing list.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's just not realistic, is it? I mean, as we were saying earlier, there's 15,000 people on the housing list, and many of those people have got young children. So if you haven't got children, you've got no priority whatsoever. And of course, many people can't afford to have children precisely because of the situation that they're in.
So because you've heard of this phrase, safest houses, and the idea is that actually if you build houses and you pay for them and you finance them, you're bound to get a decent return over a few years. In fact, if you go to the city and say, right, I've got planning permission, I'm going to build these houses and I want the money to build them, they'll lend you the money. So why aren't councils building houses anymore?
Well, the phrase safe as houses is also sometimes used in terms of if you invest in houses, you can't lose, which is, of course, the one-way bet of British
poverty.
Well,
we were hearing from Joe Banks the other week, weren't we, that internationally in the finance magazines, they advertise British student accommodation as the fastest and highest return in the world at the moment.
Yeah.
So you can invest in Bristol student accommodation. But also, the council, obviously, you know, you're going to be able to get your money back if you build houses. Why don't the council do it?
Because as George Ferguson, the former mayor of Bristol, pointed out on this show some months ago, if you build council houses, because of the rules, the people in those council houses can then buy them at a discount. So you've actually wasted money
Well, no, because they'll be paying you for building
them. The point is, Tony, what used to happen with council housing when it was built back in the 50s and so on, and the tower blocks went up in the 70s, is it was one-way bet for the councils, because, as you say, they're bound to get money back from it, and they've got a massive asset at the end of it. What happened is that all that stock was sold off, and we've still got the rules in place. As a Labour government now, we had a Labour government for 13 years. The rules are still, if you're in a council house, you're able to buy it at less than it costs to build
it.
So that's free money for the people. You're
stating that as a fact. I know several people who recently, over the last few years, have tried to, even under the Tories, have tried to buy their council or social housing, and they've just been told, no, you can't, because they just make it very, very difficult for you. Surely the real reason is that there's no political will for it. We heard from Paul Smith, didn't we, who was chair of housing here on the cabinet, and then he resigned. He said, look, I've been wanting to build social housing here. I think he politely said he retired, but of course he didn't retire. He went into a job in social housing, which he knows how to do, and he's very good at it. But he found it impossible to do it at Bristol because there was no political will from Marvin Rees, the mayor, who's now Lord Marvin Rees, rewarded for his pains. Neither was there from the senior council officer at Bristol City Council. Neither of them would let him do it. They were just putting blocks in his way the whole time. And so eventually he resigned.
Well, we've now got a green, not mayoral regime, and they could build council houses, but they're not doing it either. Yeah, now, why is that?
Maybe it's the same officers.
Well, it's the same officers, and it's also because it's been made very, very difficult to do.
Bureaucratic. Same way. I mean, what he was saying there was really interesting. Mr. Nelson, I think maybe we just call him Nelson from the Cliftonites, he was saying that the council should provide sites and provide hookups and maybe some portaloos or whatever, and I say water and electricity that they have to pay for, and they could just provide sites for people up there. Why don't the council do that? Bristol's got one of the largest proportions of the city owned by the council, the land I'm talking about. They've got the land. Why don't they do anything?
Well, you need to address that to the Green-run council, Tony.
I know.
But why don't I'm not responsible for
what they do. Well, the last council was a Labour council. They didn't do it either, did they?
No, because underlying all of this is that everything that happens in this country is about winning marginal constituencies on the first
And it's nothing
the
to do with financial lobbies like the building
yes.
industry.
Oh,
the building industry doesn't want it, do they?
The building industry are one of the main funders of the Labour Party.
Do you remember, after
and
World War II...
why do you think they fund the Labour Party? Because they want to do what they want to do.
In West London, places like Notting Hill, the government absolutely stepped in and they said, you're not going to be allowed to build here unless you build social housing and council housing too.
Well, that was the old way of doing things,
now,
Tony.
Now it's not like that. It's a free-for-all for the big boys, isn't it?
That's right. And don't forget, because they're making so much money out of all of this, they're then in a position to fund all the political parties. The builders' lobby, you know, the people who are doing the land banking, who are making all this money, they fund both the Tory and the Labour Party, and I bet you they fund reform as well. So, in other words, that's why we can't do anything.
Well, it would be interesting to see if reform ever say anything about this. They might say that just to get a few votes, and then do the opposite, just like so many other politicians do. Who knows? But anyway, there was a slightly more, I would say, measured individual by the name of Matthew Strange, and you can find him on Facebook and various other places up there. He's really lobbying for the council to step in, intervene, and find more traveller sites for all these people, these hundreds of caravans.
These people here walking are protesting against people living in vans, caravans, people in encampments. They're calling for their removal. In the words of Tony Nelson, the Downs are for law-abiding, tax-paying voters, not freeloaders. There's lots of reasons why someone might live in a van. Rents are sky high. The wait for social housing is endless. Years, possibly even a decade. But this is quite a lot of people. This is quite a lot of people who essentially believe that people do not have a right to be here, that it's illegal, that they shouldn't be here, and that the council should be doing something about it. There are a few people here that have come to stand against what's happening here, to add to the narrative, to speak something different. there are definitely hundreds of people here that have come to voice their anger and their vexation at Bristol City Council for not removing people in caravans and encampments. Price for a room in Bristol now is becoming astronomical, 600, 700, 800, 900, even £1,000. People moving from London for cheaper accommodation. Rents are going sky high. Property prices are going sky high. Many of these people, of course, own their own homes. Many of these people have received inheritance. The fact is that the boom, the post-war economy, where someone can work a minimum wage job and buy a house, is over.
Well, he's quite right. It is over, and it's been over for quite a long time. The real turning point was the early 80s. And, of course, the key policy was the political decision to sell off council housing and not to build any more.
So the millions of migrants that have arrived since, that doesn't make any difference?
It does make a difference, Tony, but that's to do with the money we're wasting on going to war in foreign countries.
No, it's like not. Running it's not. It's to do...
The Akrotiri Air Base is very expensive.
You're getting angry again.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, don't be angry. Just answer the question.
Yeah, okay.
It's an extra demand on the housing, isn't it? You know it about is. Demand and supply,
yes,
don't
I do, yes.
And you think that's extra 4 or 5 million is an extra demand?
Yes, and of course, a lot of those 4 and 5 million extras that came here to work. They came from the European Union to help build houses. One of the problems they're going to have, which Rachel Reeves is going to have now, is they want to expand housing building, affordable housing, but they're going to have problems because they haven't got enough tradespeople to build the houses because we sent them all away.
I think actually the bigger problem is that it costs so much to employ people now.
Well,
it's actually massive. I mean, with all these extra transport, rent, energy costs, how on earth is anyone supposed to afford to employ somebody?
Well, what's happened
and
is...
National Insurance too, thanks,
well,
Rachel.
The economy has started to shrink by 0.3% in April.
Oh dear, so what does that mean?
Well, what that means is there's going to be less money for everything, Tony. So whatever money we thought we were going to spend on this, that and the other, it's not going to be there. Unless we completely revolutionise the system and print our own money our own way, nationalise everything, like the water industry, which should be nationalised for zero. It's bankrupt. Why pay any money for that? And of course, what the Labour government is saying, if we were to nationalise it,
they promised 20 billion quid,
but we won't have to.
Last January, Keir Starmer promised the World Economic Forum he wouldn't do that.
Well, that's why he's keeping his promises to the World Economic Forum, Tony, because they're the people who put him in power on 33% of the vote. Just like Margaret Thatcher never even had 50% of the vote, but she sold off the council houses, and that, of course, was very important in winning those marginal constituencies under first past the post. So people that used to be Labour got their council house and spoke. People who lived in London, they got £1 million free from the government, and they voted Tory, and that kept the Tories in power, so they could carry on doing it, and they're still carrying on doing it with the Labour Party in power.
Well, the Reform UK are doing rather well. Labour Party came last in low single digits in all three West Sussex County by-elections last week. Starmer's collapse continues despite Scottish blip and makes Labour 14% last month look like an unattainable height. So the changes in these constituencies are... well, I'll just read the first. There's three different ones. They all look pretty much the same. The Lib Dems are up 32%. Reform UK is up 30%. Conservative is up, amazingly, 20%. And Labour is down.
Is this in West Sussex or in general?
Labour is down 5%.
Is this in West Sussex or in general?
This is just in West Sussex.
Well, West Sussex is West Sussex.
But they're going down, is the point. Is this an actual result from a by-election?
Yes, of course.
They're going down. I suppose that's the honeymoon period is well and truly over.
Yep. What's the problem for the Labour Party is that they're losing votes both to the left and the right. So what Rachel Reeves is doing is not satisfying people like me. And therefore we're not necessarily going to vote Labour. But on the other hand, it's not satisfying other people who on the right wing who want to see us. I don't know what they want. They want us to go to war with Iran, probably, but they may get their wish. And then it's like dogs chasing cars.
I thought reform this week, I mean, I don't agree with them. They want to destroy the NHS, I believe. They probably don't say that, but I think they do.
No, what they say is they want an insurance-based system like in the United States.
Yeah.
That's reform's position, as I understand it.
Right.
Because the NHS has failed, you see. We need more go-ahead system like
so
in the United States.
So they've come up with an interesting idea last week. I don't know if you spotted this one, Martin. They're urging the Bank of England to stop paying interest to lenders. Now, apparently, for the last 7, 8, 9, 10 years since QE started, the Bank of England has been borrowing money from private banks, and it's now paying something like $35 billion a year interest back to them.
Well, that's interesting. You see, what's happening with reform now, we don't really need to talk about what reform in general thinks, because reform is, in fact, a private company owned by
a bit like the Labour Party.
No, the Labour Party is run by the trade unions, and there's a conference, and there's a vote. The reform doesn't have any of that.
You say the Labour Party's not fixed at the top
level?
Well,
no, it's all
fixed,
it is. But it's fixed in a different way.
Yes, OK, good. Well, I'm glad you admitted that. Yeah.
Yes, it's all fixed. Everything's fixed. It's just fixed in a different way. Mm. Reform
infiltrated
is just,
by parties, aren't
reform
they? Within parties.
Reform is not a standard political party. It's a private company owned by Farage.
So and the Labour, you're not even going to pretend the Labour Party's democratic, are you? You're
I'm not going
pretend.
To pretend
good.
That.
Okay,
no, Keir Starmer
good.
Does not own the party. Farage does own Reform. He owns it. He physically owns it. It belongs
well,
to him.
Well, maybe if Jeremy Corbyn had owned the Labour Party, then
no,
things would have been
Corbyn,
different.
If he was the leader, he didn't own the Labour Party.
If he had done, maybe he could have got his way.
Yes, but in actual fact, that's not the history of the Labour Party, founded by the trade unions, if you remember. They used to be the ones in charge of
it. Maybe that's why he didn't get his way. Anyway, what do you make of this idea that you can just simply stop paying these private banks interest on this and save yourself $35 billion a year? We don't often hear this kind of question, do we?
I think what's interestingly happening all over the world is that the right wing have suddenly decided they don't believe in capitalism anymore because they know that's not very popular. So they're now
it's not working, that's why.
Well, that's right, because they're right, it doesn't work. So that's the sort of reform that would be interesting to see what 120 Tory MPs make of that, because they are the people that are being paid.
Well, they don't know what to make
interest.
Of it, because they haven't been told what to make of it.
Well, no, the thing is, the point is, what's interestingly happening in France and Britain in particular is that the right wing are becoming left wing on the economy. Now, I welcome that, but of course they've got to discuss how they're going to pay for it. I would suggest that people like Nigel Farage, who owns his own political party, are going to have to pay more taxes. And the people on the Downs going on about the council do something about this. That's right, let's go back to the old rating system, and you'll have to pay a lot more to the local council, and then you can talk about moving these people on. But you don't want to do that, do you? It's your house prices that you're here to defend. Don't forget, if we charge you more,
well, I think,
for council
I think
services,
there's a, Martin, you're looking at this in a very narrow way. I think those people who came out onto the Downs, many of them do have compassion for the homeless. They're not just thinking selfishly. It may be that the fact that this has got so enormous now, with the several hundred vehicles sitting out there, that the time has come for them to go out and have a little, what they call it, a rally, a march, a walk, whatever it was, to get together to demand the council do something.
Yes, I'm willing to listen to it, but don't forget those wealthy.
So what do you think? They should just let people stay there and do nothing about it?
No.
Not use council land? By the way, the Downs is not owned by the council. It's owned by the merchant venturers, the slave traders.
Yes. What those people need to accept, if they're genuine, is that people like them have to pay more taxes, a lot more, on their houses. Oh. We could go back to having the rating system where those posh houses
well,
up there
pay
a hell
of a lot more than... Well, how about the council just give some land? We don't have to force people out of their homes, do they? So the answer to homelessness is to force rich people out of their homes?
No, not force them out of their homes, force them to pay more taxes, Tony. And if they can't afford to live in a big house...
Then they have to be evicted.
Well, lots of poor people are evicted all the time.
Fine. Well, I don't think eviction is the answer to homelessness.
Maybe
personally, I think that's totally ridiculous and illogical.
No, it's not. Ultimately, if you look at the distribution of wealth in this country over the last 30, 40 years, it's very much favoured those kind of people.
You haven't really answered what I said about Richard Tice, have you? Deputy Leader of Reform wrote to the Bank of England Governor
yes.
over the weekend claiming that the bank was prioritising the enrichment of city institutions institutions at the expense of the public.
Okay.
Under the bank's quantitative easing program,
yeah,
which lasted from 2009 to 2021, about £900 billion was created by buying bonds from commercial lenders, which then deposited the money they received in the central bank. Interest is now paid on these reserves, which stand at around about £700 billion right now, at the base rate of 4.25%. They want the bank to do away with these interest payments. Other advocates of cutting reserve remuneration include Gordon Brown, former Prime Minister, and two former deputy governors of the bank, Sir Paul Tucker and Sir Charlie Bean. So apparently, at the time this first started, this little game for the bankers, lending money to the Bank of England and charging 4.25% interest, now we're paying $35 billion a year to them for the pleasure, was that the banks shouldn't be free from paying interest to the Bank of England because they had such a difficult time in 2008.
They should have been nationalised in 2008 and kept nationalised, Tony. Does Rice believe in that? Nationalised banking system?
Twice. What do you think? Do you think they should be paying this money on it? You don't seem to want to answer the question.
It's interesting that he's opened up this line of attack.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. I don't hear this from the Labour Party or from the Workers' Party.
We'd have to look at the proposal in detail, but the fact is we should have had a nationalised banking system. When the banks collapsed in 2008, it should have been nationalised, and quite a lot of people who were the shareholders in the banks, people like Farage and Tice, should have lost all of their money. The people who invested in Thames Water should lose all their money. That's what capitalism means. You've lost all your money. We're not paying you a penny for any of this. In actual fact, we're going to send you a bill for what you should have done.
So the Bank of England governor...
It's a class struggle, yeah?
The Bank of England governor is saying that if they don't pay this money, there could be trouble with financial stability.
Well, that's right, because the whole thing about the banks is that they rip everybody off, and then they say you can't allow us to collapse because then the economy will collapse. But of course, at that time in 2008, that was a perfect opportunity to take them all over and to move in a powerfully socialist direction, and we didn't. And of course, now they've got the banks are like a suicide bomber with a suicide vest on. If you don't give us the money, we'll blow up the whole thing. So maybe someone needs to shoot the banks in the head before they pull the trigger on the suicide vest.
Many of those calling for an overhaul claim that that is agreeing with reform, that the present system, which was introduced in 2006, is an exception rather than the norm in central banking. During the inflationary wars of the 1980s, the big central banks paid no interest on commercial bank reserves.
That's right. So in other words, it's another helping hand to the commercial banks, because they're the ones who run the show.
I think this is sort of all agreeing. Financial parasitic system.
It is, yes. It's a financial parasitic system. That's exactly what it is. And reform are now starting to question that, which I welcome. But then, of course, they've got to say, I would say to them, are you in favour of nationalising the banks?
Here is that there's far more financial nous within Reform UK as a sort of insurgent party than anywhere in the Labour Party. But what is it about the Labour Party, and maybe the left more generally, and possibly the Tories too, that have kept this sort of policy out of even being talked about?
It's because the Labour Party gets attacked by the Conservative press, the Daily Express, the Daily Mail, which then picked up by the BBC. They are irresponsible with other people's money. It's a lot of nonsense, but loads of people believe it. Many people have not got very educated about economics at all. They just presume that we've got to balance the books, which we don't. Yeah, all of that is there. And they're terrified of losing those marginal voters in those swing constituencies that I've been talking about. It's the political system as well that makes it impossible to bring new ideas forward. Yeah. Now, I welcome, if Reform want to start talking about this sort of stuff, I welcome it. But they're going to have to follow through the logic of their own arguments.
Well, they have a lot more money to play with than Rachel Reeves would. It doesn't seem she's got any idea what she's doing. Anyway, they had her little deputy, who's our local MP, Darren... What's his name?
Jones.
Chief Secretary to the Treasury, on BBC Question Time, answering some of these questions last night, or at least trying to, about the state of public services and public spending.
Since your election was trust, she did do one thing right. After 40-odd days in a job, she's now on a pension of £140,000 a year for the rest of her life. But that's not the question, is it? I'd like to know why Labour aren't going after Apple, Boots... That the guy in the corner shop's paying his fair share of tax, and yet Apple's got six people in Dublin, and that's the headquarters for the UK. It's a farce. Why aren't you going after them?
Dan?
We are. We're putting a record amount of money into HMRC to tackle tax avoidance and tax evasion and fraud. We're upgrading their IT systems to be able to catch these schemes earlier on. And we're projected to increase tax takers as a consequence.
Hiding in plain sight. They're there and they're not paying the taxes. That's a fact. And now Trump's in power. If you go after Apple, you know what Trump's going to do, don't you?
Sure, sure. I take the point. But all I'm saying is that for our tax collection system in HMRC, we're putting record levels of funding into the tax system to be able to claw that back. Well, the question on Apple is around global taxation systems. We have a digital services tax in the UK, so that where companies make profits in the UK, they pay taxes in the UK as they should. Obviously, what we can't do is claw back tax that's residing in other countries. But in the UK, we're definitely going after that and increasing the amount of tax coming into the system by tackling fraud and avoidance. But look, I just want to tackle this issue about Labour being the same as the Tories, because I find it personally offensive. I mean, we've increased the national minimum wage. We're building a new generation of council houses. We've extended free school meals to every kid in school that's on universal credit. We're paying our doctors and nurses the salaries they've been looking for years as a consequence of our investment. We've increased spending on doctors and nurses for the last 2 years when the Tories wouldn't even talk to doctors and nurses, which is why they're on strike. The thing that is the same is when Reform and the Conservatives give you the simple answers to complex promises, but do not tell you how they're going to do it. Those are the questions you should be answering.
I'll tell you what's offensive is insulting the intelligence of the British people.
I didn't. I insulted your intelligence.
Said,
answer the question.
You're entitled to insult my intelligence. You're not entitled to insult the intelligence of British people.
How?
Earlier on,
how?
You described an obvious tax hike
answer
in the form
the
of council tax increases
how?
Of 5%.
There's no answer.
The council
no
tax
answer
increases
questions.
Of 5%. You
how?
Described it, I'm quoting, as a, quote, tax change. Apparently it's a tax change. The British people are sick and tired of being gaslit, and the Prime Minister of this country does it. You can see it on his social media account all of the time. You are unwilling to be honest with the British people.
That's not
you
true.
Consistently
That's
prioritise
not
foreign citizens over the citizens of this country. And it's time you owned up to that and you stood by your conviction.
You did not answer the question how you do anything you've promised. I say what the British people are sick of, and that's false promises. That's why they voted for change of the election last
okay.
year.
To that later, so feel free to.
So, yes, he finishes. I see a Yusuf, Martin. By the way, we were all talking last week, weren't we, about the end of Zia Yusuf, him leaving Reform, and then on the Saturday he rejoined after 3 days.
Yes, okay, so it's a bit of a soap opera.
Yeah. Well, it seems a little bit more of a flaky party than others, but I think, in a way, people kind of like that, don't they?
The Keeps idea. The news,
the,
it?
Well, the idea. Well, yes, a good tactic, isn't it?
Yeah. No such thing as bad publicity.
No. Anyway, what do you make up for the points he was making there about the health service, that lady particularly intervening and saying, actually, the people that are running the health service don't know what they're doing?
Well, I mean, that's a bit of an extreme statement.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't. Not at all.
When
especially
when
we were discussing this a minute ago, weren't we? Let's hear from someone who's actually working in the health service and what they've got to say, which is what we just heard from there.
Yeah.
And we started at the beginning of this talking about how all this money was going to digital health
yeah.
and not towards actually doing operations and this sort of thing and staff in the health
yeah.
service.
Well, that's because of the marketisation of the health service. It was brought in by the Tories and then continued by Tony Blair. We shouldn't have hospital trusts. We shouldn't have an internal market in the health service. Things that are actually nationalised should be run as a top-down organisation.
But the people who are running the health service are prepared to go along with that, aren't they?
Well, what's
to keep their jobs.
Well, what's happened is we've got a huge new the various health trusts in Bristol have to actually function like private businesses. So they have to have purchasing managers. They have to have all the things that Kellogg's have to make cornflakes. That's not how you're supposed to run a hospital system. Yeah, that's not how they're running it in Gaza, for example.
They run it in America.
Like that's how they run it in America, and that's
you
the goal.
You have cost centres.
That's the goal.
So you can monitor
that's
all your
goal.
Cost centres.
And that's why lots of money gets wasted on all this stuff. The frontline services are, when the pandemic kicked in, we have the lowest per head emergency beds in our hospitals in Europe. And that's because that's a deliberate policy not to have wasted money on having extra beds in case something happened which was unforeseen. Now, a nationalised industry health service, you have loads and loads and loads of extra beds in case something happens. But of course, if it's privatised and run for private profit and basically on cost benefit analysis, then you don't, in fact, plan for the future like that. It's all based upon we've got to make money in the next quarter, which is how private industry is run.
Okay, well,
and that's what's wrong with the health service.
I put this whole idea of restructuring the way the Bank of England operates and making the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey, who's supposed to the scurrilous gossip to have had an actual relationship with Rachel Rees when she was working there, who knows, it's possibly just scurrilous gossip, but I'll leave it at that, that he doesn't really know what he's doing. He's just being told what to do by the lobbies in the City of London. But I put the concept of what reformer suggesting here, massively cutting the interest payments to private banks by the Bank of England, giving the Chancellor of the Exchequer an extra £35 billion a year to play with, to actually, for example, look after members of the public rather than cut their benefits and starve them, see what he had to say from the Workers' Party point of view of what reform had been proposing. So Chris Williamson here is a former Labour MP, deputy leader of the George Galloway's Workers' Party on these proposals by Tyson Farage.
Tyson Farage is saying, cancel this. Just pay them straight from the Bank of England. Pay off all these loans, because this interest payment is part of the reason why the country is having so many financial problems. And anyway, they should never have borrowed this money in the first place. They should have just spent it themselves.
But we don't borrow it, do they? I mean, it's a misnomer to call it borrowing, because what they're doing is selling bonds. They're selling bonds. They don't have to sell bonds. They're not obliged to sell bonds. They don't, you know, they don't need to get money from the private sector or whatever by selling the bonds in order to resource the government's spending program. That's not what it's for. I mean, it's really corporate welfare, and the kind of, you know, ironically, what Farage and company are saying is absolutely right, apart from the reference to taxpayers' money. I mean, that's another myth. There's no such thing as taxpayers' money. I mean, tax doesn't, as I've said, provision the government spending program. It's there to address inflation. It's there to, you know, deal with inequality, to actually tackle, I mean, like things like a wealth tax, for example, is important in terms of, you know, clipping the wings of these very, very powerful oligarchs. I mean, this is what, you know, taxation. So, I mean, also to drive spending patterns in certain directions.
So that's Chris Williamson there, who's a deputy leader of George Galloway's Workers' Party, actually agreeing with this tactic from Reform. It seems interesting that they're almost kind of meeting at the back there behind the Uniparty.
Yes, and as I say, it's interesting. The right wing across the Western world is now turning its back on free market economics. I mean, you can see the same thing with Trump and his tariffs. It's a pretty crazy policy, but on the other hand, that's definitely not in the mainstream economics textbook. Okay? Now, that's going to affect right-wing politics in Britain as well. And in a way, I welcome this, because we're actually starting to talk about serious things. As Chris Williamson points out there, the government doesn't need to borrow money from the private banks to cover its expenditure.
So what he's saying is that tax is not linked to spending.
No, it's not.
Well, this is what, you know, one of the things which is drilled into us the whole time.
Yes, in actual fact, it's only a convention that if the government spends money, it's got to show where the money is going to come from, which means that they have to borrow it from the private banks to show that it's real money that they're spending. But they don't have to do that at all. And of course, there shouldn't be any private banks. Yeah, if there were no private banks, there wouldn't be a problem, would there?
So I put this to Steve Hall, who's part of this informal economics working group of the Workers' Party, to see what he made of it. He was actually tweeting about this earlier in the week.
My name's Professor Steve Hall, Professor Emeritus of Criminology. I'm speaking from Newcastle. I spent 30 years researching criminality, focusing on economic crime, finance. I have a reasonable grasp of economic history, social science, anthropology, and I try to combine these disciplines in order to understand the strange mess that our world is in today. I'm here to talk about reform. And today, we got an interesting message over on social media, and also mass media were reporting this, which is interesting. And they're toying with the idea of reducing or even getting rid of altogether of the interest paid on government borrowing. This is extremely radical. It might involve a reduced interest rate at the central bank. It might involve a zero interest rate policy, a ZIRP, which is something suggested by the modern monetary theory, such as Warren Mosler and Bill Mitchell, and other heterodox economists who have been consigned to the fringe over the past 40 or 50 years since neoclassical economics, the root of neoliberalism, the system we call neoliberalism, have taken over the financial institutions and economics education. So neoclassicism, the economics of the likes of Milton Friedman, which has some roots in libertarianism and other roots in classical neoclassical economics, where they seem to think that, they don't want us to believe that the private money funds the state, that private money, and even the Marxists, some of them agree with this, I think foolishly, that the private money is created out there somewhere in markets and production and trade. And we give some of it to the state, which and put it in a pot, and then they dole it out to the National Health Service and all of the other public services and infrastructure that they need to spend it on. And it's just complete utter nonsense.
So that's Steve Hall there, Martin. Even apparently some Marxists think that private money funds the state. Why do they think that?
Well, I mean, some do, some don't. It's, I think there's...
Doesn't the left just have a bit of a problem understanding economics?
No, but some do. I mean, economics is quite a complex matter,
yeah.
And it's easy to... And, of course, it's not made any easier by those who are... The way it's presented in mainstream media
is very much for everybody, isn't it? Not just the left.
That's right.
I mean, it seems to me the only people that really understand it are the Tory party, the people with the money.
No, they understand money, but they don't necessarily understand economics.
They can pull the wool over people's eyes more easily.
Well, that's right. I mean, what you've got is... it's what... Simon Wren-Lewis, who used to work for the Treasury and is a retired economist, used to work for the Bank of England as well. He's what he calls medium macro. Most people think they know about money because everybody deals with money. So when the media says, well, the country's bankrupt and we're going to have to tighten our belts, that seems to make sense. That's the sort of decision that parents make when one of them loses a job and they've got a budget for Christmas. Well, we're going to have to, little Johnny's not going to get a PlayStation this year. I'll just have to settle for a bike. So everybody thinks they know. But of course, governments aren't like that. The national economy doesn't function like that. And in actual fact, if you study economics at a higher level, one of the first things you learn is it doesn't work like that. But most people think they know, and because they use money every day, especially small business people and people like that, they think they know, but they don't know.
So he's talking about also there about economic education. He's talking about the idea of there being a sort of groupthink amongst economic educators, lecturers, and also, of course, amongst economics journalists in London, all the main
papers,
that's
what I mean about
the television,
media macro.
The television and the radio people. So this reminds me quite a lot of what Charles Shoebridge said years ago about the Home Affairs correspondents in central London, doing all of our national and international press there, is that the Home Affairs people were basically PR people for MI5. Maybe all those economics correspondents are just PR people for the city.
Well, if you weren't PR people for the city, you wouldn't be in the role, yeah? That's the reality.
Is it that bad? Really?
Yes, of course it is. Oh, and of course it's true in the universities as well. I was talking to a guy who's a professor at the University of Economics. And I just got chatting to him in the watershed. And I said, well, do you cover any of the kind of more heterodox theories in what you do? He said, oh, no, I'll be sacked immediately. And that's Bristol University, one of the top universities in the country. He's a professor of economics. He's actually from India. He's actually from West Bengal. And I said, well, do you cover any of these other, alternative views? He said, oh, I couldn't possibly cover that.
This is awful, I'll be out.
This is
awful. If academia just has no real freedom left, and if you start to step outside of it. Yeah, well, Hudson does.
Hudson had to go to the University of Kentucky, which is where he's based, because the main, you know, like University of Chicago, Harvard, and all the rest of it, they won't have anybody in there that isn't, you know, from their point of view.
We're talking now to, I like to think of as Britain's Michael Hudson, that is Steve Hall. So from what you've been saying there about the way that this whole discussion narrative and is controlled, and therefore we're controlled through the system of money in which we all need to live, and cracked increasingly, we can't get hold of it and we need more of it just to live every day. Let's have another listen to a bit more from Newcastle, Steve Hall.
In fact, the government has been like this since the Bank of England was set up in 1694. The government is the sole sovereign currency issue. No one else can create money. And the private banks are licensed to create this new money every time they make a loan. So it's this constant, it's like, more like, not like a pot, it's like, imagine a garden hose just spraying this money into the garden. It has to be done at the correct rate. If it sprays too much into the garden, then and aggregate demand outstretches supply, then you can trigger demand-led inflation. Inflation tends to be supply side. In other words, rising prices because of supply costs, and particularly, for instance, during COVID when the supply chains were snarled up, and also because of the energy price hikes over the past 2 or 3 years, tends to be supply side. So, but demand-led inflation can be a problem. So we're led to believe that money's created out there somewhere, miraculously, even though if you try to do that, you would be arrested for counterfeiting, of course. But it's created out there somewhere, and it's gifted to the state by the goodwill of the tax-paying individual or tax-paying business. It gives them, you know, the state the money it needs to spend. It's complete utter nonsense. So this myth is the basis for the belief that the government needs to sell bonds in order to acquire private money. The central bank acquires private money, which it can, you know, it needs to for its spending. So you've got taxes and you've got bond sales. And this sustains the myth that the government runs on private money, and it's complete nonsense. So what Farage has done today is just scratch the surface of this and cast the whole thing into doubt by claiming that really we don't need to pay to woo these bond buyers by giving them loads of interest on top of their savings account. Bonds simply shift money from a checking account into savings accounts. That's all they do. This is a scam that goes back to originally in the Netherlands when huge corporations such as the Dutch East India Company had loads of reserve capital, didn't really know what to do with it, don't like taking risks with it. None of the big banks and these big corporations don't like taking risks with their money. They project themselves as risk takers. They're actually risk avoiders and risk minimizers. They don't like taking risks at all. That's why we can't get industry going back in this country. They won't take the risk because, of course, we have high labor costs, high energy costs. And it's a very, very risky investment. So bonds go back to, the 17th century. They're simply safe deposit accounts for the reserve capital of big corporations, big banks, businesses. Of course, you know, rich individuals can buy bonds too. But it's mainly the big buyers or the big institutions. So we have this situation where we offer private capital, reserve capital, floating around, doesn't have to do with itself, all dressed up, nowhere to go. And we offer them savings accounts and we pay them interest. Well, it's win-win for them, isn't it? You know, it's a great deal because it's basically an old Pals Act. There's an amazing story about John Maynard Keynes when he was working for the Treasury during the First World War. And they weren't doing very well selling war bonds. You know, people didn't want to buy them because they didn't have much confidence in their own country, and they, you know, because of, you know, powerful Germany. And they didn't, well, they weren't having much luck. So Keynes saw them actually fabricating names of bond buyers, of private bond buyers, and then simply printing the money and using it to fund the war effort. It's simply fabricating the whole thing, which indicates that really they don't need to sell these bonds. How do they pay them off? Well, they simply print the money and print the interest in 10 years or 20 or 30 or 40 years' time, depending on the maturity debate, whether they're short or long-sell bonds. So they just, you know, they print it anyway. So why can't they just print it now? As long as the money in circulation matches the productivity, matches the supply, then you don't get inflation. Aggregate demand, and it has to match in, you know, supply. So the whole thing's a scam. It's a con. Now, Farage hasn't come out and said, it's a scam, and we don't accept bonds at all. But he's just sort of poked a little hole in the dam of that ideology by saying, well, why should we pay them loads of interest?
The figures are amazing, really. 700 billion in these bonds, apparently. And by not paying this interest, we could be saving the Exchequer 35 billion a year.
Well, we could. But, yes. We've been paying them all this interest since 1694. I mean, I should have to think what the accumulated total of that might be. Why do we do this? This is an old concept. We give them savings accounts and we give them interest. Of course, it's legally enshrined that all savings accounts must pay interest. Why is that legally enshrined? We could trace that back to the law, moving over to the creditor side from the 14th century. It's ridiculous how much power what Michael Hudson calls the creditor class have over nations. And I think the last time we spoke, I was telling you about the combined stock, Forex and bond markets trading at $160 trillion, the equivalent of $166 trillion every day. This massive market money power. They can swoop down and be, threaten nations' currency, if the Forex markets, which is the sort of warhead of this weapon that they have floating around the world. If they sell off a few billion, they get the cascade effect where everyone loses confidence and they all start selling it off. And then devalue currency, make our imports more expensive. Businesses close. And the government lasts as long as Liz Truss. I think we spoke about that last time. So this whole scam that is the creditor classes, the grip on nations has, Farage has just poked a little hole in that. And people are thinking, well, if we don't have to pay them interest, then why are we taking them? And we don't spend this money. They're savings accounts. It's ridiculous. The whole idea that we need bonds that we're borrowing. In fact, a currency issuing government doesn't need to borrow anything at all. It needs as much tax as it needs to keep the supply of money down below the inflationary limit. And it's a good way of doing this because it can redistribute some income at the same time. So it can create more social equality at the same time as controlling inflation. So that's a win-win for the public and the state. But this is not what the creditor class want. The creditor class make their money by investing and pocketing returns. That's how they do it. So they do not want the state to have the ability to invest and spend public money and crowd them out of these investment markets. Now, the last person to reduce bond sales in this country was Attlee, of course, when he nationalised coal, gas, electricity, and was setting up the National Health Service in that period, 1945 to 51. when they laid down the foundations of the Keynesian welfare state. And they also installed capital controls to prevent money going out of the country, or prevent some of it going out of the country, to retain enough to make sure that some investment was, was put back into industry in this country. Now, I think we spoke last time about how they start to circumvent this through the Eurodollar market using the territories, the old crown territories of the empire. We've all heard of them. And, you read the work of Nicholas Shaxson and others, the Cayman Islands and Jersey. So they circumvented it to some extent. And, of course, Thatcher got rid of the capital controls altogether. Now, the whole idea is to disempower the state, disempower the working class, and hand over financial power to the private creditor class, which is, of course, a globalist complex of institutions, the big hedge funds, the banks, the investment banks, etc., who can go around the world, put their money where they want for the highest return. That's a very simple principle on which they operate. Now, Attlee, to some extent, he didn't go the whole way. And I don't suppose Farage would ever go the whole way. In fact, we have to suspect that Farage might do absolutely nothing at all, and this is just a gesture. But even if it's just a gesture, it's still a smarter move than Reeves telling everyone that we have no money, we can't spend it, you're all going to have to suffer austerity, you can't have a winter fuel payments, we can't fund the NHS properly, we can't nationalise Thames Water. And you must probably know more about the shenanigans going on there, about the bonuses and all this, even though they've made a complete mess of it. Why should states reimburse private investors who take, who are supposed to take a risk? They don't want to take any risks, do they?
Well, that's pretty much accurate. Because he's quite right that by raising this question, Reform are sticking their toes into the non-orthodox financial universe. But of course, the implication of what they're saying is that ultimately we should move to, and I think this probably will happen because the mainstream system is breaking down. They'll be forced to do the kind of things that Steve is talking about there.
Martin, can you say something about why it is that there's so few people like him around?
Well, if you want to make a success, in the City of London or even in academia, you've got to actually, you've got to go along to get along. And there is actually quite an established tradition of people critiquing all of this stuff. But of course, that's not the mainstream. If you read The Economist, the extraordinary magazine where all of the articles are written by AI and always have been, because no individual will say who wrote what article. But of course, there's a whole thing in The Economist about, nobody's allowed to rebel against the free market ideology, and it is an ideology. It's not actually based in any real scientific basis at all. And the maths of it behind it is all wrong, as Benoit Mandelbrot discovered fractal mathematics quite some while ago.
Basically, you can just make the money up and spend it. No one's going to stop you. Anyway, Hannah, can you hear me?
Hello?
Yes, okay. So you're live now, Hannah. Just tell us what's been going on over there in Stockholm?
Yeah, well, it's the usual, Tony. Obviously, Bilderberg 2025 is well underway from the 12th to 15th of June. Today, Friday, actually, we had a few people, a bit of movement Friday morning that we weren't expecting. Some people seemed to be going in and out. Some people were leaving, perhaps due to events in Tehran. But apart from that, it's business as usual. We've got a luxury hotel, which is heavily locked down, like immense security, and 120, 125 or so of the most influential people in the world.
Okay, so look, it's very central. It's very much in the city centre, isn't it? Without actually much of a cordon, in a great contrast to some of the venues, which are out in the middle of nowhere.
but don't forget they've had city centre venues before, like Ottawa, for example. And a lot of the sort of interest and attraction has kind of diminished recently in recent years. So maybe they just feel they can get away with it again.
No, that's a pity, because we had thousands of people here in Watford in 2013. So who's been coming in? Who's in there and who's leaving? It'd be nice to think that some of them will walk out after last night's attack on Iran.
I don't think they were walking out so much as they probably had business to attend to. I don't think they were walking out. Alex Karp and Peter Thiel were in and out a lot this morning. I think Alex Karp left. I think Peter Thiel left too. Certainly Alex Karp's yoga mat left the building. That was packed and went off in a car and went round the corner. And also Peter Thiel was spotted leaving. But those guys go in and out a lot during the course of the conference. And you can always tell when they're about to go out because they always travel in cars with German plates. It's odd, but they do. But yeah, maybe they went to Tel Aviv. After this morning session shut at 12:30, they were out, and at least the yoga mat was, and off they went.
Okay, so what about the most interesting thing, it seems to me, on the agenda is we've actually got depopulation on this time.
I know, yes. Quite brazen. Do you think Albert Borla was speaking at that session, maybe?
So who's he?
I don't know. The CEO of Pfizer is in there. But I feel that after recent events, I just think they might have rejigged the agenda a bit and expanded the Middle East sessions a little bit. I think they really will be discussing that.
So anyway, how have you been getting on getting photographs and, more importantly, I suppose, getting them into the international press?
The Swedish press are great. They're all here. It was on the front page of some of the national newspapers. There were some TV shows this morning, breakfast shows dedicated to it, which is unusual. At least the British press, they're not interested. They really are not. The New York Times wasn't interested. It's not something we would normally cover unless something extraordinary happens. Daily Mail have covered it in the past. This year was like, it's not interesting to them. I was like, there's royals there, there's this. Oh, no one's interested.
Well, I mean,
no one's interested.
Well, they are, I'm afraid. It's just the press. I mean, the thing is, there's so many press in there. Maybe it's their bosses that are telling them not to be interested because they've got to keep
stung. Yeah, but look at the press, Tony. Look who's in there. The Economist, Zanny, Minton Beddoes. You've got Bloomberg, John Micklethwaite, Anne Applebaum, also ostensibly a member of the press. Or a publisher or whatever. These people are not necessarily Gideon Rackman, Financial Times. Do you think they're the press, or do you think they are sort of like MI6? What do you think?
Well, they're investors with nice jobs that want to keep their money and keep their jobs, and they just so happen to have a printing
press.
Some
of them might have nice jobs and got a good thing going, but press speaks.
So who have you actually seen? Who have you actually managed to get photos of?
The usual. Eric Schmidt is always out and about. He quite glories in it. He really doesn't care about having his photo taken. He's a bit like Kissinger. In fact, he kind of slightly relishes it. Kissinger always used to love having his picture taken by us. Who else? The Greek Prime Minister left abruptly after the morning session, got the Swedish Prime Minister coming in last night for the inaugural meal, which was almost a welcome feast for NATO, because obviously Sweden and Finland are joining NATO, and this is almost like a kind of celebration of that, this hosting of the event here in Stockholm. Who else have we got? Who haven't we got? They're all here. Mark Rutte, Secretary General of NATO, we've got. Well, who I haven't got and who I would love to get is Wes Streeting, who is also on the list. Haven't got him.
Yes, well, we've just been talking about his restructuring of the health service and bringing in all sorts of new digital solutions. I'm not sure if he's going to manage to get the waiting list round. But anyway, why do you think people like the Daily Mail or Financial Times should be covering this?
Well, I think we've got our elected representatives in here, hobnobbing with hedge fund moguls, AI bosses, you know, kind of shadowy intelligence chief. And it's just odd. There's no press oversight. There's no transparency. Obviously, they say it's all done under Chatham House rules, so no minutes were taken. There's no sort of transcripts of the discussion. It's a great big lobbying shop, to be honest. If you've got politicians in there with all these banks, hedge funds, and corporate CEOs, I mean, they're just sort of lambs to the slaughter, aren't they? They're in there for three days. They're cut off from all of their normal ties. It's an extremely intensive schedule. They're kind of really flattered and love-bombed in there. I mean, you have all the ingredients of a cult.
Well, yeah, especially since they don't like saying anything about what's going on. Now, I noticed a very sort of dark-looking Peter Thiel being followed along by Dan Dix at pressfortruth.ca yesterday. He actually looked like quite a troubled individual, quite someone who's actually got a lot of kind of secrets, dark secrets. He was looking like he really didn't want to be filmed, and quite a... So who? I mean, he's now quite a central figure. Back in the old days, I remember covering this in the early noughties, the main man seemed to be on the steering committee, at least one of the main people, anyway, was David Rockefeller, who was very convivial, very chatty, always looked quite relaxed. Thiel is a completely cut from a different cloth, isn't he?
He is, and he is very influential. He recruited Alex Karp, who came once in 2014 as just a participant, and then immediately went onto the steering committee, and also now the CEO of Anduril, another Thiel startup, has attended a couple of times, and maybe we'll see him on the steering committee. And yes, Thiel did look troubled during that confrontation, and he has changed a little bit. In Dresden, he did open up a bit, and he was talking, and he sort of wants to share his philosophical outlook a little bit. And in fact, we've seen that with the recent interview with the Hoover Institute, where he was talking about his philosophy and his theories based around the Antichrist and how people would be asking for peace and safety, which is when the Antichrist would present itself. So, but yes, he looked troubled. He's not a happy man.
I didn't know about this. I mean, you know, talking about the Antichrist, we've just had this attack on Iran, the Iranians doing a kind of... Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the same night as Bilderberg convened, which I think several people...
Yeah, Friday the 13th, it all happened. Bilderberg met, and also apparently there's a very explosive astrological configuration on Sunday as well, so we shall see what happens Sunday. But yeah, Thiel is very interested in the concept of the Antichrist, and he believes that people will be driven to such a degree that they will be demanding peace and safety, and they will sort of, you know, worship whoever gives it to them and comply with whoever gives it to them, and that person or thing will be the Antichrist. I don't know if that's AI, I don't know who that is, I don't know what that is, but Thiel is fascinated by this. So, yeah, he's a brooding figure, he really is. He's a Heathcliff figure, and he thinks about these things very deeply. He is troubled.
He is, isn't he? I mean, of course, the idea really here is that you have to create absolute chaos for somebody to come along and offer peace and safety to the world, don't you?
Yeah, so first of all, you create the chaos, and then first it's the Antichrist, and then later along comes the Messiah. And I don't know if this is the kind of the theological kind of foundation upon which the Bilderberg Group is basing their kind of outlook and philosophy, but yeah, they're certainly thinking about these things, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think David Rockefeller was into this sort of stuff. You possibly Kissinger was. No. He seemed to want to use it basically to accumulate wealth, money, resources, and more power. Yeah. Anyway, so he was an oil man who turned into a banker. What do you make of all of these tech giants that are there? I see even Spotify's turned up this time. Elon Musk is a regular, even though he's not on the list this year. He certainly could turn up on a video link. It's exactly his sort of event, isn't it?
Possibly. I don't think they would welcome the publicity Elon Musk would bring. I can't see it. I think he's a bit too much of a showman for them. They really love discretion. You know, they're not tweeting madly on drugs like Elon Musk is. They are discreet and they think very carefully about the messages that they put out. Sorry, that's the ferry. I'm just here in front of the gates of the Grand Hotel right now, and we have ferries directly opposite the hotel. In fact, some are thinking that tomorrow night they will walk over to the water and take a boat to a nearby island for their usual Saturday night banquet. Apparently there's a nice castle on an island nearby, but we shall see. We shall see what they do.
Okay, well, look, we can't talk about Bilderberg without mentioning NATO, because Sweden has been on the fringes of NATO for decades, actually helping out quite a lot in the Baltic, the NATO countries, unofficially. And now it's formally there. It's almost as if this, like you say, is a big celebration of some sort of a new member of their club.
Well, I think it started off as a celebration. Certainly last night, the Prime Minister, Christensen, turned up, and I waited until 1 a.m. and I didn't see him leave, so they were chinking glasses well into the night. But obviously this morning, it's no longer a celebration, is it? It's sort of like, you know, it's business as usual and it's deadly business. So Sweden is waking up to a hangover and realizing what they've got themselves into as a part of NATO. Yeah, so Sweden and Finland were both welcomed into NATO, and Oskar Stenström, who was the main negotiator for this deal for these Scandinavian countries to join NATO, is actually the organizer of this Bilderberg conference this week. And he is now a Wallenberg employee. He works for Jacob Wallenberg. And he's organising this entire massive conference.
Yeah, do you want to say something about the Wallenbergs? Because it's never in the press here, but these people basically dominate so much of the press and politics and finance in Sweden, don't they?
They dominate finance in Sweden, but also Europe. They are crazily wealthy. I think they're the second wealthiest family in Europe. They're certainly the wealthiest sort of family holdings in Bilderberg. The Wallenbergs have a perpetual family seat on the Swedish seat of the steering committee. It is always held by a Wallenberg. So it was Jacob Wallenberg, and now it's Marcus, his cousin. They're crazily wealthy, and who knows how they amass their wealth. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, I can tell you, actually, quite a lot of it was because they had very, very big oil interests and arms interests in World War II, and the two brothers in the war were on both sides. So they knew that as the war drew to an end, wherever the profits had been made from both sides could be drawn into a neutral country, such as Sweden or Switzerland. You know, so that's basically how they... In fact, it's funny, but Shell did exactly the same thing. The petroleum company owned by the Dutch royal family, who are also big Bilderberg players. So
in fact, the King of the Netherlands is here this weekend as well.
I can remember years ago, Hannah, talking to Klaus Kopf, who had confronted one of the participants of Bilderberg at his very own... he was at the German one in Dresden, at his very own further education university college in Hamburg. And this guy said to him, Where do you live? If you want to investigate Bilderberg, you want to investigate the people who are in charge of peace and war. Where do you live? So he was refused the permission to write his piece about the Bilderbergs and had a confrontation with this guy. But anyway, he was adamant, someone that had actually been there behind closed doors, not being recorded, but just recounted by Klaus to me, that they do control peace and war. Do you think that there's any credibility to that?
Well, I mean, look at who's there. It's NATO, and it's everything propping up the structure of NATO. And does NATO want peace? No. And have we got war? Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think if these people in this building wanted peace, we would have peace tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right.
And we don't.
Yeah. No, we don't. Can you just say something about some of the atmosphere there and people who are covering it, Hannah?
Yeah, it's very subdued. It's not like former days. You know, we've gone back to about maximum 10, you know, steady Bilderberg watchers. There's a few pro-Palestinian protests about the place, and they have got interested when they can see, you know, who's behind perhaps some of these conflicts, you know, who created this instability in the region, who, you know, is selling weapons perhaps to the Israelis and propping up that regime, but it, you know, it's quiet. It's quiet here. It's you know, there's music. There's a local bar. We can hear the music. The ferries are coming and going. You know, the sunlight is twinkling on the river. And yet, you know, Tehran has been bombed, and you know, Ukraine is in this state, and the Middle East is in this state, and you know, and the people are inside talking about it.
I was just saying, it seems to me that the idea of these conferences, as much as anything, is to bring in some of these new people, like Streeting, and keep them under close observation. See, like, is this guy on side or not?
Yeah, to see if they're on side or not, to maybe sort of, like, test the water. But also, and I think you've said this before, Tony, it's such a hothouse environment once they get in there. It's such a cult-like environment, but it's very hard for them not to, you know, accept the consensus. This is a way of sort of like creating consensus, and these new people, I mean, obviously occasionally they don't want to accept the consensus, and they're just never asked again. But if they're asked again, you know, oh, they're a clubbable individual, we can work with him, and they, you know, they're flattered. They're flattered to be invited. It's special. They feel special. And, you know, you've got the royals, you've got all of these big names, international names, supranational names, supranational wealth, and they kind of enjoy it. You know, they enjoy being there. They get some special insights. They probably shine in a couple of the sessions, and no one's invited back who doesn't really speak out and is barky and, you know, makes a name for themselves. You have to really impress. You can't just sit there quietly and not say anything and maybe take notes in the corner. You will never be asked back. You know, you have to be vocal and contribute. And I'm sure Wes Streeting will do well for himself. You know, he's a likeable man, you know, he's confident. Sure he will. But we shall see if he's asked back.
Yeah,
maybe Lammy was. He went three times, didn't he?
Oh, Lammy, yes, of course, yeah. I wonder if Wes Streeting had any trouble getting in, like David Lammy did back in Lisbon. That was hilarious. They wouldn't let him in. I mean, it just shows you what pay grade these politicians are.
Well, not without the lanyard. I mean, even Peter Thiel yesterday, that's why he was so furious, because he'd forgotten his lanyard, and his bodyguard had to go ahead and say, you know, can you let my client in? He doesn't have his lanyard. And his client was Peter Thiel. So, yeah, you have to have that white ribboned lanyard to get in through the cordon.
So So I think one of the useful things to have for the Bilderberg watchers and people taking pictures like yourself, Hannah, is a few lanyards in your pocket.
Loads of people with white lanyards turning up.
Anyway, so whereabouts is a good place for people if they want to follow what's going on there? I mean, there usually are little leaks and things like that. I don't. I'm sure you would have told me if you've managed to get anything out of anyone.
Have we? No, it's all been. We haven't got any extra thing. I mean, you saw the footage with Dan Dix and Peter Thiel. He was completely monosyllabic, if that. And in Dresden, he was talking a little bit. So people are very quiet right now.
I think it's got more serious. I think
it seems to Eric Schmidt, he never said anything. Yeah, it's got more serious, especially today.
Yeah, as the Antichrist edges closer, maybe he's in there.
God. Maybe he is. I think he is in the form of AI. I mean, all the AI bosses are in there. The only person that isn't there is Sam Altman, and he has been twice before. But they're all in there. Google, DeepMind, you know, the Microsoft one, you know, they're all there. Anthropic. There's about seven or eight AI billionaires in there.
So, I mean, we keep getting pushed this whole AI thing, don't we? I get rather fed up with it. I mean, we've just been told here in the UK that they're going to allow AI-controlled cars in a few months' time to start driving the roads. What do you think AI is really all about, Hannah?
That's a big question.
It is,
Tony.
It is a
big
question.
Is it peace and safety? Is it the Antichrist? I don't know. AI is about everything. It's about every aspect of life. For Bilderberg this year, AI is about defence. It's AI deterrence and security. And actually, we had a very intimidating drone yesterday whizzing about over our heads, presumably with Palantir software. Literally whizzing not very far above our heads, obviously taking biometric photos of us all. For them it's defence. And by defence I mean, you know, weapons, war.
Killing, actually.
Drones,
the kill chain.
Yeah, so they've got Palantir, but also Thiel just started up Anduril, and he was there this year, and the CEO of Anduril, and he was there 2 years ago. And they're working together with, I mean, Eric Schmidt was working with the Pentagon until quite recently with AI, his AI project. So, yeah, they've just repurposed it, and it's not about, you know, improving the lot of humankind, but, yeah, they're just repurposing it for war. For them, AI is war.
Yeah, so I would imagine.
And surveillance, yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine
which
actually.
Is a war on the population.
I mean, for me, the whole purpose of AI seems to be to extract the human from decision making, and to make it some sort of little bit of software that makes the decisions instead. Because the humans have got a soul, they've got sometimes morals, and so we don't really want that. We would like to have a decision-making process that just dispenses with all that stuff. And we're being sold this, basically, as some sort of great thing, where actually there's something like $1 trillion a year going just into the research and development of AI, which could, of course, go into far more positive things. Anyway, look, Hannah, you've been absolutely fantastic telling us all about what's going on. Please, could you just let us know, if people are interested in following all this, apart from going up, I set up a Bilderberg 25 Telegram channel, which people can post to, and I'm putting various stories, including the relationship with potential, anyway, with the weapons being developed by Bilderbergers being employed against the drones, obviously being employed against against Iran, and these sort of weapon systems. So those are the people who are in there are going to make money from this. If this really kicks off, it's rather worrying to think that. Where is a good place to, would you suggest, to go follow stuff? And do you think there'll be anything in the UK London press about it?
Charlie Skelton usually covers it in The Guardian. I believe his piece will be out over the weekend. Search on Twitter for Bilderberg 2025. The pictures are coming out. They're coming out slowly. Dan Dick, Press for Truth, .ca is great. He's just uploaded a big report. But I think the pictures will be coming out over Twitter over the next 2 days. And also we'll be updating bilderbergmeetings.co.uk with some more pictures and a report of this year's conference. So, but you just need, Twitter is good. Your Telegram group is great. Giorgio Bombasse on Twitter is good. But right now we're just sort of desperately trying to get the pictures. We haven't uploaded as many as we could. And there's always next year as well. And if anybody ever feels the urge for a foreign holiday, we will publicise it on bilderbergmeetings.co.uk and on Twitter where the next location is, when it is, in plenty of time so people can get cheap flights and come and join us. Because, you know, it's a good place to meet like-minded people.
Yeah.
Anything that you get, any pictures, any quote, anything is useful and sort of expands our knowledge of this group and how they operate. And, it's a good place for us to network too. So I encourage people to come along next year when we find out where it is.
Well, one of the things we don't like to talk about too much is the fact that you often do find even Bilderberg participants, I mean, I have over the years anyway, do want to talk about it, even though they're told expressly not to. So they may chat to you off the record. And also there are officials, as I found over in Dresden, not the actual German police or anybody like that, but people who are involved with the press coverage that just want to come and tell you, right, yeah, well, this is happening, that's happening, this is happening. And so then we can all pass that.
You're good at getting these confidences. Oh, but I remember in 2012, they always open up to you, Tony. That's why we need you to come more
sometimes,
often.
Yeah.
But in 2014, Copenhagen, I remember, I think it was the CEO of Norsk Hydro, big energy company. And he was broken by it, and he was like, oh my gosh, he goes, it was such hard work, so many meetings, oh, it's just, he looked broken by it, he hated it, and he never was asked again. He really didn't like it. I think for some people, it's just they don't thrive in that horrible, hothouse, pressurised environment, and they're never asked again.
No, well, is Norsk Hydro privatised or nationalised?
I don't know.
If it's nationalised, I can understand why.
And
listen, since you are telling that little tale, I could tell a tale of the Greek finance minister back in 2003 who came out for a packet of cigarettes, and actually he really just wanted to talk to us about the horrors inside.
Yeah. Wow. That's so interesting.
It was so lovely.
Margaret Thatcher, they didn't like her. And they instigated a coup against her. And also John Smith, he went once, wanted to go back and tell them what they were doing wrong, didn't he, with the economy and their approach to finance. And never got the chance, did he?
No, because he died. He wanted to come back with Brian Gould. He insisted, actually, look, we want a proper financial person to tell you guys what's what. Oh, dear, he died.
He never got
to do that. And, of course, Tony Blair jumped into his shoes, didn't he? But the Greek finance guy back in 2003 at Versailles was absolutely lovely bloke and actually was shaking all of our hands. Thank you for being here. And he said that the atmosphere was horrible inside, absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Peter Thiel, I mean, I honestly think, Hannah, we've both been covering this for quite a while now, they're on a hiding to nothing in there.
Yeah, I hope so.
They are. I mean, whatever happens.
They're pretty sure of themselves, Tony.
Well, they're plotting and planning death and destruction, but at the end of the day, that is not going to come, I think. They will get much of their death and destruction, most likely. But their evil intentions are already being exposed. I think it was, wasn't it Dan Dix that said to Peter Thiel, he said, the American people are waking up to what you're doing, Peter.
right. And Peter Thiel just looked furious.
Even more furious.
I don't know, he's troubled.
He was even more furious than he was before at that point, which was unbelievable.
Poor old Peter. I mean, I shouldn't feel sorry for him, but he's not a happy bunny.
He
is anyway.
A happy bunny. He needs a bit. He needs someone to love bomb him, I think. Anyway, look, Hannah Borno, thanks ever so much for joining us again from live from Stockholm.
Great chat with you, Tony. Oh, I hope you're coming next year. You better do.
I hope so.
Can you pledge now on air?
Okay. Oh God! All right. Bless you. If I can afford it, if I can afford it, I'd be there now. If I could afford it, Hannah, I promise you, I would. I'd love to.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well done. Next year. Right.
We'll be following all your stuff over the weekend. Thanks ever so much for joining us.
Okay, take care. All right, bye.
Bye.
Well, it's obviously interesting to have a, you know, horse's mouth discussion of what's going on in Stockholm. I think the real significance of Stockholm, as you both suggested, is that they've joined NATO. And, of course, there's just been this Ukrainian secret attack on Russian nuclear bases, an attempt to assassinate Putin, and the blowing up of the railways bridges, which killed loads of people. I think that NATO are going for broke here. And I think they probably are thinking, well, what's going to happen next? Because it's not clear that they know exactly where they're going with all of this. It astonished me the other day, Tony. I was talking to my friend Diana, who's an academic professor in Liverpool University, and she didn't know that there'd been an assassinate attempt on Putin.
Neither did Donald Trump.
Although in actual fact, no doubt we're going to come on to discuss that. Perhaps he did know, but that's another question.
He didn't. He didn't seem to know anyway.
When
he was confronted with it at a press conference, he was like, what are you talking about?
Yes, but he didn't seem to know.
So this is the way these things work, isn't it?
Well, it can be, but there's all sorts of other things floating around.
There's this thing
there
called the deep state. Bilderberg actually represents that.
Yes, indeed, but also...
Trump is not in that circle.
Well, Trump this today was saying, I told the Iranians that if they didn't do a deal with me after 60 days, nasty things would happen.
But we weren't talking about that, were we? We were talking about the assassination attempt on Putin.
Yes, I know, but I'm just saying the question being asked all over the internet, Tony, is what did Trump know and when did he know it about all these things?
We all know the US president is only told things, as the British Prime Minister is only told things when it's necessary. MI6 and the City, the financial and arms people, they control most of the narrative nowadays.
It looks like to the Iranians is that Donald Trump has been a willing participant in disarming them before this attack
we weren't talking about that. We were talking about Ukraine, and you've just completely
shifted. Yes, I know,
shifted.
But I'm just pointing out the question. So, there are various theories about this.
Okay, so the one thing that's fascinating about this attack on Iran last night is the use of these container drones. So
which
this
is
exactly
they
the
used
same
in Ukraine.
Tactic.
Yes.
The Ukrainians have used these. So are the Ukrainians and the Israelis working together, or is somebody else supplying these nice little containers full of drones?
You know who's behind these container drones? It's the British military and security services.
Is it?
They're the ones in Ukraine, certainly. Now, of course,
they cooperate
with the Israelis as well. We're actually training Israeli soldiers
here in Britain
at this very moment. Yes.
Even though we're voting, isn't it bizarre? We voted last night. The British ambassador voted for the ceasefire, but at the same time, we're still training IDF soldiers. I mean, I also put a link up on our show page at thisweekdog.uk to, I think, is it Declassified?
Yes.
I'm not sure who it was that reported that, showed that that's taking place, picked up by some of the other newspapers as well. But anyway, this is... I looked at this, first of all, this spat between Musk, as we were saying last week, and Trump as a way of him sort of cocking a snook, the deep state and the tech giants cocking a snook at Trump, particularly for his attempt to slow down the war and have peace with the Russians, alleged attempt anyway, which has completely failed because it looks as if it's the Europeans that are really pushing this war, plus their friends in the US deep state. But the connection between the Bilderbergers and the attack on Iran is another one. And this is all happening last night. All these Bilderbergers arrive and we see the attack on Iran taking place. It may even have been that the announcement was told to Trump, oh, it's going to be 60 days. And that this is something that you can imagine the senior Bilderbergers on the steering committee, they're all cock-a-hoop. They're going to make loads more money if there's a big war in the Middle East between Iran and Israel.
Well, Alex Karp is on the record as being absolutely pro-Israeli. I mean, we had a quote from him the other week. You had a clip from him, didn't we? Where he was going on about, you know, anybody who's in favour of Palestine just supports Hamas and all the rest of it.
And terrorists.
The tech billionaires are absolutely embedded with the Israeli armed forces, as our own armed forces. Yeah. So what we've got here is it's either there's two things going on. The state in Britain has got two hands to it. You know, some people know something, other people know nothing. It's increasingly becoming clear to both the Russians and the Iranians that this is a nice cop, nasty cop routine. So Trump pretends he doesn't know what's going on. And same with Starmer and Streeting and all the rest of it. They do know what's going on. And of course,
I'm not sure they're in the loop.
I think this is the jury is out on this, Tony.
I think Bilderberg is in the loop, though.
Yes, the jury is out on this, whether they're deliberately misleading the other side.
I mean, let's just read through.
Both the Russians and the Iranians will be absolutely foolish to believe anything they say.
The list of the Bilderberg steering committee. These are the, because there are some Brits on there, aren't there? In fact, one of them is, it's the right piece of paper.
You mean the ex, John Sawyers?
John, ex-boss of MI6, he's head of MI6. So he's sitting there setting the agenda, he's sitting there deciding who to invite, and of course he's in a position with the financial people and the media people, also on the steering committee and on Bilderberg, to give the positive or negative press coverage that certain events and individuals need.
That's right. So what coordinates the relationship between the big money guys and the military is the intelligence services. I don't see any Russian intelligence people on here at all.
Well, there's only the NATO
countries.
No, they're
just not on there, are they?
There is a Russian, apparently a guy who spends most of his time in Russia, but he's from the Carnegie Endowment.
Well, that's right. So, in other words, this is very much the in-house meeting of NATO.
And these foundations, they also play a role, don't they? You made a fantastic point a few weeks ago about the oligarchs we talk about. Actually, the philanthropists, and that's what Carnegie is. These are people with massive amounts of private wealth that call themselves charities, but they are particular. I mean, they're in there. They're in the Bilderberg right now.
Yes, and of course, the whole idea is we don't need taxes. We were talking about taxes earlier, taxes and spending. We don't need taxes because all these billionaires are going to create foundations which will pursue social goals, and therefore we don't need any governments. Yeah, this is where this is all going. We're going to get rid of the boring old democratic state, and we're just going to have corporations run by on corporate lines, where you know the people in charge are the people in charge, and everybody else has just got to do as they're told. That's the efficient way to run things, Tony. Surely.
Well, I mean, I talked a bit last week about the links between the Nazis and the Bilderbergers. Certainly, it seems to me to be a financial kind of Fourth Reich organisation, particularly when for the first 20 years, Martin, it was chaired by a former SS officer.
Well, that's right. I mean, the history of Bilderberg, which you have researched in detail, it was essentially set up to be the bridge between the former Nazis in Germany, who were being rehabilitated, like Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was also implicated in betraying the Allied cause at Arnhem, which you've written a book about, and the Anglo-Zionist elites. So this is the people who are behind a lot of what goes on. Of course, even though there's a conspiracy, it doesn't mean they always get their own way. You know, things go wrong, even to, you know, the best laid plans and all the rest of it. But this is definitely what this is all about and has been all along.
A lot of Bilderberg seems to be focused on seeing Russia as the big, big bad guy. Oh, why
absolutely.
Is that, do you think?
Well, because it's, as you say, it's NATO that are behind all of this, and Russia, when Yeltsin was in charge, they were quite happy to have Russians to come along, and even Putin, when he first took over, because he was keeping Zyuganov and the communists out, they were quite happy to talk to him. But since he's started to get rather independent-minded, they lust after the wealth of Siberia, and they want it for them. They don't want it for the Russians. But the Russians to their credit, aren't going to let
the
them
The Russians have also been sticking their finger in Syria, haven't they, over the last few decades?
Well, they've been doing stuff. They've been doing stuff all over the place. I mean, the Russia is a big country with a lot more global
reach.
But
it seems the Russians have decided, OK, Syria's going to have to go. We're more interested in sorting things out in Ukraine than
Well, I think the thing is that the decisions made by the Russian general staff about these things, Tony, will be based upon information which we don't have. OK? They're also supporting these revolutionary governments which have emerged in West Africa. Traoré in Burkina Faso, for example, who's a spiritual descendant of Thomas Sankara, who was assassinated by the French in the 1980s. And the Russians are, and the Chinese are, working all over the world to frustrate the Western imperialist setup. And Bilderberg is the Western imperialist setup. Yeah. That's what they're trying to subvert.
Okay, so I was rather shocked and amazed to hear this bit of news about the Israelis attacking Iran last night. It looks like the response has been fairly muted with just a drone response. But the run-up to it was very interesting, wasn't it? This whole business of Benjamin Netanyahu facing a possible re-election with the Knesset dissolving parliament. I mean, this is putting pressure on him to actually ramp up the war, isn't it?
Yes, that's true, but I don't think it's just to do with Netanyahu's personal salvation. This is obviously a very carefully put together long-term plan. And what's happened is that the Iranians have been very foolish by talking to the Americans in the way they did. They presumed that as long as they carried on talking, they wouldn't be attacked. And of course, it's been demonstrated to them. The same is happening in Russia. People in Russia are concluding, both political elites and the ordinary people, that there's no point talking to the West because they deliberately deceive. They did it in Minsk 1 and Minsk 2. The Iranians have been trying to sort of avoid war here by talking, and their top people have all been murdered. Just like the same thing happened with Yahya Sinwar from Hamas and the Hezbollah chief Nasrallah. So it's very dangerous to talk to the West and try and do deals with them. And I think the downside for the West going forward is nobody will talk to them because it's a death sentence. So we're not going to talk to you anymore. And of course, they are within their rights to fight back. We've got a whole list of a death list here. Yeah. There's a death list here for somebody. Maybe the Iranians. This is the list of people at Bilderberg. Alex Karp, for example, who spoke out about his support for Israel the other day.
And he said that everybody that my Palantir software is killing is a terrorist.
That's right. That's right. Well, maybe he'll get his
maybe
wish.
Maybe he'll get some
Maybe
sort
some
blowback.
Terrorists will find him.
Blowback.
Yeah.
Anyway, before we leave the subject of Bilderberg, we all love Dan Dix. He's one of the most lovely chaps you could ever meet. And I met him several times at these Bilderberg meetings. I had a right laugh at the recent one in Lisbon with him. And so here he is chasing Peter Thiel. We were hearing a little bit from Hannah about that earlier on. He managed to catch him yesterday, chasing him down the road. And Peter Thiel, this really, really stony face on him. I mean, he's got a kind of pockmark, cocaine-y type face anyway, but he was looking extremely angry and upset. This is the guy who's behind PayPal. He financed Palantir. He's financed Facebook originally as well. So he's a bit of a dark financial tech guy. But here's Dan spotting him, trotting over to him and chasing him down the road, asking him a few questions. Peter Thiel and Dan Dix yesterday in Stockholm.
Mr. Thiel, do you have any comments about Palantir's surveillance of the American people, sir? Or any of your connections to Jeffrey Epstein? You're setting up a Big Brother surveillance system, and people know it, sir. Do you think the American people want this surveillance tech being used against them? You're meeting with them. People are waking up to what you're doing there, sir. That's why we're here covering this. Wow, Peter Thiel was booking it. That man picked up the pace. The second the word Epstein came out at CMD, started getting a little faster. Stone cold Peter Thiel. Of course, co-founded Palantir with Alex Karp, who is still here. And these are the guys who are setting up the Big Brother surveillance system, essentially to track, trace, and database everyone. Not just Americans, you may have heard me say that, but literally everyone. And that's big reason of part of the reason why he is here. There is a lot of heavy kind of tech representation here and military men who are preparing for something.
So that's Dan Dix there. You can follow him on his pressfortruth.ca, press F-O-R, truth, as he pointed out to me yesterday, not the number four, .ca, and also on all sorts of different social media. He makes a point of listing all of the different things like Rumble, Odyssey, but not YouTube, Martin, as the YouTube people are in there. And they've cancelled his channel a couple of times. But he says at the end there, enigmatically, they're preparing for something.
Well, I think what they're preparing for is already in operation, isn't it? The what's happened in the last couple of weeks in Iran and Russia is the worst end of what people were predicting might happen in both cases. And no doubt some people in there know exactly what's happening because they were behind it.
The annoying thing about all this is, of course, it's being supported by the so-called Democratic West.
What is being supported by the Democratic
West? Well, whatever they're up to. The war in the Middle East.
The so-called Democratic West is exactly what it is. And, of course, what we're seeing here is the end of 500 years of Western domination of the world system.
But they're not going down without a fight.
They're not going down without a fight. That's absolutely right.
So the other thing that Dan noticed was right next door to this great big hotel is also the Grand Lodge of Swedish Freemasonry, which he spotted.
The Grand Lodge of Freemasonry for Sweden. You'll see some of the symbols on the window there, the classic checkerboard floor. It almost looks like an eye in a triangle and the Red Cross. This is, again, the main lodge of Freemasonry directly across the street from the Bilderberg Hotel. And, you know, I find it interesting because there's a lot of similarities between both the Freemasons and the Bilderberg group in the sense that within Freemasonry, the lower degrees are not privy to some of the information that's revealed when you work your way up. In Freemasonry, the lower levels are referred to as the outer core or the outer portico, and the true info in regards to what happens with Freemasonry is reserved for the adepts, they say. And very much like Bilderberg, there too is an inner circle within the inner circle, much like Freemasonry. And here we are, just right across the street from the Bilderberg Hotel is the Grand Lodge of Freemasonry here in Sweden. So I find it pretty interesting that it's adjacent and that interesting correlation there. So just wanted to bring that to your attention, guys. Crazy stuff. When did the Bilderberg start publishing the agenda list and meeting? That's been going on for a while?
It's been going on for at least, I think, 10, 15 years or so.
Didn't they used to have press conferences in the 60s?
I think later, late 90s.
Huh? Interesting. Yeah. So that's basically a press spokesperson from the Bilderberg meeting.
Yeah, who just lied to Dan as he managed to get one of the press spokespeople for PR officers for Bilderberg, who was saying, oh yeah, we used to hold press conferences in the 90s. Actually, that's a total lie. They never did. And what they did hold press conferences was back in the 1960s and 1970s sometimes. But when the press had noticed that they were there, and if they got press inquiries, they would sometimes hold a press conference. I remember seeing some statements by Henry Kissinger, and I think it was maybe the Norwegian Prime Minister possibly speaking at a press conference, reported in one of the papers as if it was normal. But then when C. Gordon Tether at the Financial Times started writing about it in his Lombard column, he was from right the way through the 1960s and 70s and into the 80s one of the most famous and loved columns in the FT. He was sacked, Martin, as soon as he mentioned the Bilderbergs. He was told, no, we're not printing that, and if you insist, then you can leave. And he did.
Well, we've been discussing this all night. If you want to have a career inside the system, you've got to go along with what the system expects. Otherwise, they're not going to employ you. And sometimes people are brave enough to take a risk and say what they want to say. But of course, they will then not necessarily run with the piece. So, you know, you'll be out, but you won't get it out there, not through conventional means.
Don't have a lot, but with me that's fine. Whatever I got, well, I know it's mine. Hey! I don't go around with a local crowd. I don't take what's in, so I guess I'm out. I'm saying these things so you know me, baby. So you better know what I'm all about. The boat that I row won't cross the ocean. The boat that I row will get me there soon. But I got the love if you got the notion. The boat that I row's big enough for two. Me and you. There ain't a man alive can tell me what to say. I choose my own side and I like it that way. Hey! I don't worry about all the things I know. There's only one thing I want, I ain't got. I'm saying these things so you know me, baby. You better know. The boat that I row will get me there soon. But I got the love if you got the notion.
Propaganda. Propaganda by Jewel. Can you hear me? You can. Okay. Propaganda by Jewel there. And I can't hear anything, but anyway. So that's from 1985, and I think the lyrics are really wonderful. It's great the way that bands in those days used to sneak in sneaky bits of lyrics. People didn't know what they were. I think it was Ease a Good was quite a good one. That was in the 1990s, a Prodigy or somebody. And
The Shaman.
Was it? Okay, yes. The Shaman, they Move Any Mountain as well. They were wonderful, weren't they, The Shaman? Then before that, there's The Boat That I Row by Lulu. The great long song at the start there was by someone called Pastor T.L. Barrett and the Youth for Christ Choir, Nobody Knows. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Thanks ever so much to Hannah Borno, reporting photographer, who you may see something from her in The Guardian, of course. The de-educators, the Nazis of the Fourth Reich, want to try and stop that getting into your newspaper. So any photo of Hannah's that managed to make it in is a massive blessing to humanity and a curse on anybody. Well, I'm not cursing anybody, but it's horrible when they try and stop us learning what's going on or knowing what they're up to. Because that's a fascist system and a fascist state that they're running, isn't it? And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why Peter Thiel was in looking a little bit black and dark, because he's up to no good. And it shines out a mile. It's a bit like a copper in the police canteen who's taken a load of money from the heroin dealers in order to help them get off. And that's taking two salaries. That's the sort of atmosphere you get around a copper like that as well, around Peter Thiel, on a rather bigger scale. Crook, and they think they can get away with it. Ah, right, okay, so they can a little bit, but it's a horrendous price they have to pay psychically. So lots and lots of money, but no soul. Welcome back to the show. The propaganda thing there by Jewel, it's in a way I played that on, well, I did play it on purpose, because this was doing a little bit of digging around this week, and for our sort of almost like our main item of the day, in fact, which is a look at the Baird, John Logie Baird, was supposed to have invented television, wasn't he, here in the UK. And there were various competing systems going on in the 1930s, so who's going to invent TV? John Logie Baird installed Crystal Palace South Tower Studios back in 1933. That's in South London. Remember, the Crystal Palace had been built in Hyde Park, massive for the Great Exhibition. Glass atriums and transepts, like a gigantic cathedral made of glass, but full of all sorts of things from all around the empire, and flags and things like that. But also lots of demonstrations of things like steam engines in there. They had everything, really, the Great Exhibition. So in 1935, the BBC, inventing TV at the time, moved into Alexandra Palace with Marconi EMI, who were testing a rival system of television, 405 lines. Baird had 240 lines, but was working on a new system which would be even better than the Marconi EMI system. So they'd been developing it. They had a lot of scientists working for Baird who'd been working for a long time. EMI and Marconi were relatively new to the game. And so they were quite confident that they would get the contract to do television for the BBC. The reason I mention Crystal Palace is because that's where the Baird lot were based, but that also meant that Baird had to actually split work and staff up to Ali Pally in a similar sort of hill in North London. So the BBC then began transmitting regularly using both systems, television alternate days or weeks. That all began on the 2nd of November 1936. And this was the month, November 1936, was a sort of race began over which of these two systems were going to be adopted nationally for the future of television. And, of course, many other countries around the Commonwealth used the same system that was decided on at that time. But anyway, something funny happened, something called the Crystal Palace Fire on the 30th of November 1936. So just about 3 weeks after this competition between these two television systems started. And I'll put some links up on our show page to bits and pieces about the fire. And in January 1937, that's a couple of months later, after the Crystal Palace fire and Baird's studios in the South Tower. And underneath the south side of the, he'd rented 40,000 square feet, apparently, underneath the, to use for studios and research and development of television, under the south side of the Crystal Palace Tower, the BBC chose, guess what? Marconi EMI. Just after the Baird system, which was catching up and overtaking Marconi EMI, was burnt out the previous 2 months previously. The South Tower and much of the lower level of the palace had been used for tests by television pioneer John Logie Baird for his mechanical television experiments, and much of the work was destroyed in the fire. Baird is reported to have suspected the fire was a deliberate act of sabotage against his work on developing television. So two night watchmen were attempting to extinguish a fire in the office area in the centre transept in the Crystal Palace. The main studio, office and lab area under the south transept was overlooking the terrace, was all occupied from 1933 until the fire by Baird. This could, I mean, it could possibly be that this was just a way of Marconi EMI kicking the Baird lot out of the game, because they were catching up and about to overtake them to do this new invention called television. Both of those. So anyway, I'll put some links up to that on our show page, some of the links and information about the dates and a bit of a timeline and the statement by John Logie Baird that he believed that was why the Crystal Palace. But of course, Martin, the Crystal Palace fire was a big, important event historically. It was just a couple of years before the outbreak of World War II. And it was almost like it was the Great Exhibition was a great sort of flagship for the Empire. It was gone, all burnt down.
It may have been, as you say, a deliberate attempt to get rid of Logie Baird's version of television. I'll tell you who wrote a lot about this was G.K. Chesterton. He wrote a lot of stuff about Marconi, because Marconi were involved in all sorts of skullduggery. I can't remember all the details, but G.K. Chesterton, the author, he was very on top of all of this stuff about how Marconi was. And, of course, also Marconi were the, in recent, more recent times, loads of their executives were assassinated, if you remember. And there's a lot of questions about that. I'm just digging this up out of the files in my mind. I can't really say any more than that, but if people are interested, that's where to look.
Yeah, maybe. Because obviously television at the time, we had films for a while, but TV was obvious. There was obviously massive potential in this. The other thing is that site during the war was used by the military, the Crystal Palace site, for doing things like trying to disrupt, sending out electronic signals, trying to disrupt the German radars and things like that of aircraft that were coming to bomb London. So, in a way, it was quite... it was a centre for all that stuff. And then was the Crystal Palace Tower was built in the 1950s, which is the big transmitter for the whole of London. But you can see it was bizarre, wasn't it? And interesting to me that they were using these two spots, the high spots in North London and South London. And it was the North London lot that won and the South London lot that got burnt down in 1936, along with the great symbol of the British Empire. So anyway, back to realpolitik today. Benjamin Netanyahu, he has made a statement late last night about his attack on Iran. I mean, this, I think, he's calling Operation Rising Lion, Martin. This has been something that he seems to have been itching for years.
That's right. So in a sense, it's not that much of a surprise that they've finally gone and done it. He himself has left Israel, and I think he went to Akrotiri, and he's now going off somewhere else. So
Bilderberg?
I don't know, but I mean, you know...
Stockholm?
Well, obviously, we're on live on air now, and it could well be before the night is out, the Iranians will have started to fire back. I understand the missiles that have been fired so far, from what I was reading, have actually come from Iraq. and they're not from Iran at all.
So they have actually, the most significant thing about all of this is all of the tactics that are being used by Israel and Ukraine are the same. These decapitation strikes, the idea is they're not trying to beat them on the battlefield. They just want to destroy their morale by killing their leaders.
That's right. And of course, the Ukrainian drone troops were in Syria helping Al-Qaeda, Giuliani, to take over. So that, but one of the things that they were doing is the they were using Ukrainian personnel were showing the Al-Qaeda people how to use drones.
Well, the military and political leaders that they're pretending to negotiate with.
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. What's happening here is it's very, very nasty, because what they do is they've been talking to the Russians, they've been talking to the Iranians, they've been talking to the Hezbollah, they've been, you know, because people want peace, because they generally do, and of course there are neutral countries out there like China or whatever, India, you've got to be seen to be trying to talk to them, otherwise you're looking unreasonable. Are you following what I'm saying? But of course, it looks like these IA.
So this is just for the benefit of the domestic public. So the people in Britain, at least they're negotiating. No, actually, they're not.
It's for their own public in Russia, for example. You know, the middle class mums.
What about here? What about here? Our public. Well, so it's good to think that the Americans. Oh, it looks like the Americans are trying to get a peace deal with Iran.
Well, that's right. But I mean, the point is, anybody who talks to them going forward is obviously a fool. Because they will use any information they gather from that to kill you, not just to subvert your policy, but to kill you personally. So a lot of these scientists that have been killed in Iran, they've been killed in their own homes, they're the top people, and they've been fingered by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Authority, have told them where to go and find them. So the Iranians, in good faith, have been cooperating with the IAEA to show that we can, you know, we'll cooperate with you, we'll show you what we're doing, these are the scientists you're going to deal with. And those scientists, the IAEA, have given the Israelis their coordinates, and the Israelis have killed
them. Dan Dix is making a fuss about Big Brother surveillance. This information is valuable and can be used to kill you, mate.
Well, the obvious thing that anybody going forward is going to draw from this is do not talk to them, have nothing to do with them, and possibly the other alternative, and I'm not recommending this, is find out where they live and go around to their houses and blow their brains out in front of their kids.
Yeah, well, actually, what we were hearing last week was the idea of from John Bosnich was the idea of dropping an empty missile in somebody's Downing Street garden, saying, look, we could have blown you up today, but we didn't.
Well, the IRA did that in 92, if you remember.
Well, that wasn't an empty
bomb. They put a bomb right into the Downing Street garden, and they were just unlucky on the day. All of the war cabinet...
Lucky on the day. Somebody
unlucky
was lucky
on the day.
John Major was lucky on the day.
John Major was lucky. The IRA were unlucky. Okay.
Well, maybe it's just sending a message. And in fact, maybe that's what one of the reasons that Major finally decided he was going to, after all that, the three massive bombs in the City of London area, Bishopsgate and Canary Wharf and the rest of them, he finally did sign the peace away because he'd literally nearly been killed by the IRA.
Well, that's right. But of course, there's threatening people and attempting to kill them, and there is actually killing them. But of course, what's happened in Iran is the people that you are supposedly negotiating with, you have killed them all. Now, what will happen? The next lot of leaders coming forward, same with Hezbollah in Lebanon, same with Hamas, they will not be talking.
Well, that's
to
the
you.
Intention.
They
maybe,
will
isn't
not.
It?
No, anyway, they will not be talking to
you. Let's just have a listen to the logic of Benjamin Netanyahu, the man who thinks he can create chaos in the Middle East, and he's apparently has always thought that ever since that seems to have been his mission since being a little boy.
Moments ago, Israel launched Operation Rising Lion, a targeted military operation to roll back the Iranian threat to Israel's very survival. This operation will continue for as many days as it takes to remove this threat. For decades, the tyrants of Tehran have brazenly, openly called for Israel's destruction. They've backed up their genocidal rhetoric with a program to develop nuclear weapons. In recent years, Iran has produced enough highly enriched uranium for 9 atom bombs. 9. In recent months, Iran has taken steps that it has never taken before, steps to weaponize this enriched uranium. And if not stopped, Iran could produce a nuclear weapon in a very short time. It could be a year. It could be within a few months, less than a year. This is a clear and present danger to Israel's very survival. 80 years ago, the Jewish people were the victims of a Holocaust perpetrated by the Nazi regime. Today, the Jewish state refuses to be a victim of a nuclear Holocaust perpetrated by the Iranian regime. Now, as Prime Minister, I've made it clear time and again, Israel will never allow those who call for our annihilation to develop the means to achieve that goal. Tonight, Israel backs those words with action. We struck at the heart of Iran's nuclear enrichment program. We struck at the heart of Iran's nuclear weaponization program. We targeted Iran's main enrichment facility in Natanz. We targeted Iran's leading nuclear scientists working on the Iranian bomb. We also struck at the heart of Iran's ballistic missile program. Last year, Iran fired 300 ballistic missiles at Israel. Each of these missiles carries a ton of explosives and threatens the lives of hundreds of people. Soon, those missiles could carry a nuclear payload, threatening the lives not of hundreds, but of millions. Iran is gearing up to produce 10,000 of those ballistic missiles within 3 years. Now just imagine. Imagine 10,000 tons of TNT landing on a country the size of New Jersey. This is an intolerable threat. It too must be stopped. Iran is now working on what it calls the new plan to destroy Israel. You see, the old plan failed. Iran and its proxies try to encircle Israel with a ring of fire and to attack us with the horrible attack of October 7th. But the people of Israel, the soldiers of Israel, rose like lions to defend our country. We crushed Hamas, we devastated Hezbollah, we hit Iranian proxies in Syria and Yemen. And when Iran directly attacked us twice last year, we struck back inside Iran itself. Yet in defending ourselves, we also defend others. We defend our Arab neighbors. They too have suffered from Iran's campaign of chaos and carnage.
So that's the first bit of Netanyahu's speech last night, Martin. Rising lion, he calls it.
Well, obviously, I mean, there was an agreement with the Iranians that was signed off during the Obama era.
He says they're developing nuclear weapons. They're going to be sending tens of thousands of ballistic missiles full of tens of thousands of tons of TNT or nukes if they don't do something.
Well, the Iranians, if you remember, only attacked the Israel directly after their diplomats had all been murdered in Damascus.
So you're saying the Iranians don't want to destroy Israel?
They do want to destroy the state of Israel, but that doesn't mean they want to nuke Israel. That's just, why would they want to do that? Don't forget, we've got Iranian politicians like Smotrich and Gvir, who've now been told that they can't come to Britain, but they were openly saying we should use nuclear weapons on Gaza. Now, that just shows how mad they are, because, of course, Gaza is right next to Israel. If you use nuclear weapons on it, you're going to irradiate yourself. And, of course, even if they were able to destroy Iran, or Iran were able to destroy Israel without the other side doing anything about it, you would still have a massive catastrophe for your own economy and your own people. It's just silly. Now, the Israelis are not supposed to have nuclear weapons. According to the Logan Act, which is a US act that was passed years ago, anybody who develops nuclear weapons outside of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty should be put under automatic sanctions.
So who's Logan?
Logan was a senator in the US who brought forward the Logan Act.
He was a bit of a superhero because he also said that nobody should be allowed to go to a private meeting like Bilderberg and they should be prosecuted as a criminal if they did. No senators, no politician, elected politicians in the States are allowed. That's also prosecutable under the Logan Act. So this is obviously quite a valuable piece of paper.
Well, that's right, but of course it's just been ignored.
Yeah.
Of course, the Israelis are not allowed to
have... So this is the prosecutors. This is the role of Crown Prosecution Service in this country and in the States, the federal prosecutors. So these are part of the criminal cabal, aren't they?
Well, that's the problem, is there are rules against this, but they're ignored when the powerful are involved. The Israelis should not have developed nuclear weapons at all. They stole a lot of what they got from the Americans, and some of it was given to them by the French.
Well,
they're not supposed to have them under international law. at all.
Laurent Guillaume's rather wonderful documentary, Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers.
Well, indeed, because Kennedy was very unhappy with them developing, you know, basically stealing US nuclear weapons, and he was going to try and put a stop to it. So they killed him in order to prevent that. And, of course, it looks like LBJ was involved in that. And then he allowed the Israelis to knock out or kill loads of people on the USS Liberty. And, of course, the anniversary of that was not that long ago.
Well, look, the Middle East Eye, wonderful there, we believe, funded by Qatar, even
yes,
though
they're a bit weak on Syria,
Jonathan,
for that reason.
Jonathan
actually.
Cook doesn't know, even though he writes for them. I mean, he was saying he thinks they are funded
by
Qatar.
They're definitely
they definitely
funded
pay
by
him. You know, his proper paycheck does come through, but it's a little bit of a mystery as to where it's actually from, which I think you'd probably say the same about The Guardian and people like that. But anyway, so the Middle East Eye, Martin, I don't know if you saw this, had done an investigation into Cameron. Cameron threatening the International Criminal Court. I mean, so let's have a listen to what the substance of this is now. It's all to do with David Cameron, former British Prime Minister, Conservative austerity man, little chummy and pally with Dr. David Kelly, and on a little funny little trip down to South Africa many years ago. Anyway, and also, of course, chosen by King Charles at the end of the Remembrance Day service to become our Foreign Secretary, not by Rishi Sunak at all, as they all marched off on that Sunday back in, I think it was 2023, at the end of the cenotaph ceremony, and the next day he was made Foreign Secretary, and no one knew anything about it except Rishi Sunak, King Charles, and Cameron himself. So even though, of course, he's a failed politician, he should have been thrown in the rubbish bin of history like Tony Blair should have been. But anyway, he is back and he is batting for Israel. Surprise, surprise, Mr. Cameron.
The British Foreign Secretary threatened the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, reportedly telling him that issuing arrest warrants against Israel would be akin to dropping a hydrogen bomb. The threats happened in a phone conversation in April 2024 between the UK's then Foreign Secretary David Cameron and the ICC prosecutor Karim Khan. It happened weeks before Khan called for arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, and three of Hamas's senior leaders. The warrants accused Netanyahu and Gallant of using starvation as a weapon of war, as well as murder and persecution against Palestinians in Gaza. While the charges were celebrated by many in the international community as a necessary step to holding Israel accountable for its actions since October 7, they were met with hostility from the United States. In February this year, the Trump administration sanctioned Karim Khan, freezing his bank accounts in the UK and barring him and his family from traveling to the US. Then last week, those sanctions were extended to the ICC judges, who approved the arrest warrants. But while the US and Israel have long rejected the International Court's authority and are not signatories of the Rome Statute, the UK is, and is bound by the court's decision to arrest the Israeli leaders. Yet, according to former staff working at the ICC prosecutor's office, David Cameron warned Karim Khan that the UK would withdraw from the ICC and defund the court if it was forced to make that decision. In a heated phone call, Cameron reportedly told Khan that going ahead with the arrest warrants would be like dropping a hydrogen bomb, and that it would make the ICC look like it was losing the plot. Khan responded to Cameron's threats of withdrawing from the Rome Statute, saying that if it were to occur, then it would have to accept that the rules-based system would be dead. Cameron replied, saying that Khan was making a huge mistake and that the world was not ready for this. A month later, Karim Khan went ahead with the charges, indicating that then no unknown figures had attempted to intimidate him and his team.
It is critical in this moment that my office and all parts of the court continue to conduct our work with full independence and impartiality. And I insist that all attempts to impede, to intimidate, or to improperly influence the officials of this court cease immediately.
Now, to help tell us more, we are joined by one of the reporters that worked on that story, MEE political reporter Imran Mullah. Imran, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You worked on the story. You have been digging into it for some time. Tell me how it all came together.
Well, this was a story that required some investigation. So David Hurst, the editor-in-chief of Middle East INI, went to Amsterdam to visit The Hague, which hosts the International Criminal Court. And there we spoke to several sources with knowledge of this phone call. They knew what had happened. Some of them were former staff in the office of Karim Khan, the chief prosecutor of the ICC, and some of them had seen the minutes of this meeting between Khan and David Cameron.
So there you go. It does sound a little bit like hearsay. It'd be nice to actually hear Cameron ranting and raving, wouldn't it, and threatening. But apparently that's the case. David Cameron threatening the International Criminal Court as if it's his place to do that, to say, no, you're not allowed to stop this genocide. You're not allowed to institute international law. You've got to stop it right now.
Well, I mean, the public positions of Cameron were pretty much in line with that, weren't they? So whatever, you know, it's his hearsay what he said in private, but he was publicly saying that, you know, there isn't a genocide going on here, there is no case for the
International Criminal Court to be involved. Another prime ministerial professional liar, Secretary of State professional liar.
Well, I mean, you know, that his positions publicly are clear that he was...
He's been recycled because he's a liar.
Well, that's how he was brought in because they thought of him as an elder statesman, for God's sake.
A safe pair of hands, yes, someone who will lie. We know
he was
lie.
Largely responsible for the destruction of Libya. That shouldn't have happened. There was no basis for Western powers to get involved
just a tool of the Israel lobby is actually very much more powerful here in Britain than people realise, it seems.
Well, I think that's going to become increasingly clear as we go forward. Because, of course, this little shindig that's going on this weekend in the Middle East is going to knock everybody's plans about the economy for six. So everybody talking about what we were talking earlier on about the...
I hope you've got an electric car.
Well, I think...
oil price, mate.
I hope we've got somewhere to live, Tony, because that's where we're going. We're going to have a situation where loads of people aren't going to have anywhere to live and they're not going to have any money, and that's going to be directly because the oil price has just gone crack way up. The stock markets are all way down, and this war's only 24 hours old.
Yeah? And it's not even started.
It's not even started yet, so anybody who's thinking that it's time to get married and have a family and settle down, that was against the nuclear sites
in Iran. The oil sites are down the road somewhere, aren't they?
Well, that's
if
right.
The conflict gets bigger.
Well, I mean, the oil price has been shooting up, and of course, if oil fields start being attacked, which could happen any time, then it'll go through the roof.
Oh, we haven't got any coal. Sorry. Well, but anyway, this also happens to the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn was interviewed recently, and he talked about very extreme pressure being put on him to support Israel come what may, basically to join the cult, which he refused to do, as you'll hear here.
During one extremely hostile meeting of the Parliamentary Labour Party committee, they confronted me and said, will you give a blanket undertaking that you, as party leader and potentially prime minister, will automatically support any military action Israel undertakes? And I said, no, I will give no such undertaking. I will give no such agreement, because the issue of Palestine has to be resolved. And the Palestinian people do not deserve to live under occupation. And the siege of Gaza has created the most incredible stress. And by the way, I've been there on 9 occasions in Israel, Palestine and the West Bank. When the Israeli forces started attacking Gaza after October the 7th, October the 7th was wrong, the response of killing tens of thousands of people doesn't bring anybody back and has created the hatred and the wars of tomorrow and the year after and the year after. So was I surprised at this support for Israel? No, because the pressure of Israel on the Israeli government, on the Labour Party, is huge. But then again, there's also some wonderful people in Israel who very bravely oppose what their government is doing and oppose the occupation. But I was absolutely shocked when remarks were made which appeared to me to undermine the whole principle of international law, of the bombing of civilian targets is a war crime.
It sounds to me like the Israel are basically a very powerful nuclear-armed criminal gang who are threatening all sorts of British elected representatives that want to see peace in the Middle East, Martin.
Well, that's right. I think the ordinary people in this country need to wake up. The Israelis are potentially going to kill us all. Because if this escalates and a nuclear weapon is used, it'd probably be the Israelis nuking Iran, then, of course, the Russians aren't necessarily going to stand by. So if you want to live, you need to stop the Israelis.
Well, the Israelis are very famous for the false flag operation, aren't they? Would they nuke themselves?
Well, no, they wouldn't nuke themselves.
Might they?
Well, that's not even a false flag, is it? That's committing harakiri.
Well, no, it isn't. It's saying that it was from the Iranians.
Yeah, but the Iranians haven't got nuclear weapons, so that's a load of
rubbish. Could lie, couldn't they?
Well, they could have been lying.
They lied on 9/11.
I'll tell you
They lied on 7/7.
Yes, they lied.
Maybe they could
lie
again.
All the time. What may happen now in Iran, and it's perfectly feasible for them to do this, if they decide that Ali Khamenei, who's the supreme leader, you know, because he's the spiritual leader, he may say, well, we're going to issue a fatwa. Up to now, we've been saying we don't want nuclear weapons. But if you're going to do stuff like this, then maybe we will have nuclear. I tell you what, nobody would dare to do this to North Korea, would they? North Korea have got nuclear weapons and nobody dares to attack them. If the Iranians had nuclear weapons, the Israelis wouldn't dare to attack them. So there's a pretty clear message.
So why do the Iranians? Iranians today attacked Israel, apparently with some drones, as the Israelis do have nuclear weapons, and they've got these wonderful German Dolphin submarines a whole load of Trident missiles.
Well, there's always been a position. Sheldon Adelson, who's Miriam Adelson's dead husband, who gave Trump £100 million, $100 million for his election campaign, he openly said in one of his casinos in Las Vegas, "We should just nuke Iran." Turn it into a car park.
Well, one of the Israeli ministers also said that.
Yes.
Nuke Gaza.
Well, yes, we'd also nuke Iran, because nuking Gaza is a non-starter, but they could nuke Iran, because it's far enough away that there would be fallout effects, but it wouldn't directly kill people in Israel. But you can't presume that the Russians or anybody else is going to allow that to happen.
As these people drag us towards chaos,
chaos, annihilation.
Peter Thiel's Antichrist is rubbing his hands together. Ooh, that's been nice. But anyway, let's have a little bit of a listen now to a bit more from Netanyahu, because he does this funny thing where he says, he appeals to the people of Iran, the people of Syria, please rise up against your evil leaders. I'm the good guy. I'm coming to help you, which I just find... it's somewhere between creepy and laughable, isn't it? I mean, does anybody actually believe this stuff? What do you think, Martin?
Well, there are elements within Syria, for example, like Al-Qaeda Giuliani. He wants to make peace with Israel, and that's what he's going to do, because if he does that, then there'll be less off sanctions and so on. So Al-Qaeda has always been aligned with Israeli Mossad and Western intelligence services, but the Russian general staff are well aware of this, as are the Iranian general staff. Now, if nukes start being used, then everybody's going to start using nukes. So Iran may go down first, Israel will be next, and then everybody else is going to follow them over, you know, because once it's started, it's not going to end there. Well, Israel should never have been allowed to have nuclear weapons in the first place. Probably, with hindsight now, they should never have been allowed to exist as a state. They should have been told in the first place, you can't have this state.
Will the Iranian people rise up against their evil leaders?
No.
Are there counter-revolutionaries?
I'll tell you what's obviously happened in these internal attacks inside Iran is MEK have been very heavily involved. They're based in Albania now, and they are a sort of... They were a Marxist Islamist revolutionary group originally, but they've now become onto the CIA MI6 payroll. They're kept in their main camps are in Albania. They obviously have played a big role in the commando attacks inside Iran. Now, inside Iran, you do have people who are not happy with the regime. They're not necessarily the majority, but they're there. And of course, they can then be used to carry out these attacks and so on. The Iranians have got a real problem there, but I don't think after this kind of attack that the ordinary middle of the road Iranian people are going to feel any more well disposed towards Israel than they were. In actual fact, it's making them a bit mad.
I hate to say it, but I can imagine them all yesterday evening. What watching this on the Bilderberg, on the screen, these attacks into Iran, and then also secretly watching people like Wes Streeting. Is he happy or is he sad? Anyway, let's have a listen to Netanyahu appealing to the people of Iran.
Our actions against Iran's proxy Hezbollah led to the establishment of a new government in Lebanon and the collapse of Assad's murderous regime in Syria. The peoples of those two countries now have a chance for a different future, a better future. So too do the brave people of Iran. And I have a message for them. Our fight is not with you. Our fight is with the brutal dictatorship that has oppressed you for 46 years. I believe that the day of your liberation is near. And when that happens, the great friendship between our two ancient peoples will flourish once again. I want to assure the civilized world, we will not let the world's most dangerous regime get the world's most dangerous weapons. And Iran plans to give those weapons, nuclear weapons, to its terrorist proxies. That would make the nightmare of nuclear terrorism all too real.
Well, I mean, obviously, they've been working very hard to try and overthrow the regime in Iran for many years. Obviously, Iran is quite a very complicated country with lots of, you know, they're very technically sophisticated. And of course, as I said,
well, they've managed under sanctions for many years.
That's right.
And didn't they build, I think, the biggest tower in the whole of the Middle East?
No, that's a different. That's
they got overtaken by Dubai or something.
Yes, that's right. Dubai's got the biggest tower.
Yeah.
Anyway, they. But of course, Israel itself is split. You know, there is, you know, that one of the reasons which we hinted at earlier why Netanyahu might decide to go now, because the religious parties are about to maybe pull the plug on the current setup and they'd have to have elections because they don't want to serve in the army.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition partners have threatened to bring down his rule as they have unanimously decided to bring a motion to dissolve the Knesset. This amid a fierce dispute over whether ultra-Orthodox Jews should continue to be exempted from military service, a question that has divided Israeli society for decades but now has become a politically explosive due to the ongoing war on Gaza. The war has exposed cracks in the army's ranks and placed immense pressure on the regime to distribute the burden of the military service more equally, as reservists continue to be deployed for extended periods. Frustration has grown over the special status enjoyed by the ultra-Orthodox community, who receive funds but do not serve.
This is a historic crisis that has exploded because of the war. The war has intensified the need for more recruits and placed a huge burden on reservists. Even though Netanyahu wants to grant them exemptions, he is paralyzed by internal pressure from Likud as well as civil society. We might see a last-minute compromise, but it will only buy time. The real crisis will haunt Israelis for years to come.
The trigger behind this latest rupture is the looming Supreme Court deadline requiring legislation to regulate conscription of the ultra-Orthodox, with ultra-Orthodox parties demanding sweeping exemptions. Other right-wing groups are resisting what they see as inequality.
This law has always been controversial, but the ongoing war in Gaza has made the need to enlist the Haredim even more pressing. There's a growing sense of injustice that the ultra-Orthodox don't fight or sacrifice, yet receive massive funding.
Well, not only that, it's their ideology which is driving much of this in this far-right coalition that they've now put together in Israel.
Yeah, the ultra-Orthodox are quite split amongst themselves as well. Some of them are very supportive of the war on the Palestinians. They just don't feel that they have to be in the army because they're so religious that they don't want to go in the army. Some ultra-Orthodox are actually anti-Zionist. They don't believe in the state of Israel. So, you know, I mean, the idea...
Well, this is very perverse, isn't it? You've got this Zionist ideology, which actually is racist, which is driving this government, and yet they think the people who are driving the war say, well, everyone else can die, the secular Jews can die, but we can't.
Well, that's one strand within the ultra-Orthodox community. Another strand is actually rejecting of the State of Israel.
And, of course, this is a very good reason why Netanyahu might have decided to up the ante against Iran to stop this election taking place.
That may be so, but I suspect that there's more to it than just his survival. It's a longer-term plan, and I think it's more to do with you know, long-term plans by the kind of people that are going to Bilderberg.
Yeah, well, what do you think Nigel Farage and the Reform UK make of all of this?
Well, I don't know, Tony. You're going to tell us, aren't you?
We are. I am. I certainly am.
Today, we are announcing sanctions against those individuals because we have been absolutely clear. This has to stop, and we stand for a two-state solution. And the settler violence that we've seen in the West Bank particularly is entirely unacceptable and must stop.
So the result of this is that Itamar Ben-Gvir, the security minister, cabinet minister, Israeli cabinet minister, and Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, will both have any assets they've got in the UK frozen and been banned from entering the United Kingdom. It's also interesting to hear David Lammy there effectively talking about a two-state solution. I'm joined in the studio by Zippy Hotaveli, the Israeli ambassador to the United Kingdom.
Good evening, Nigel.
Good evening. Israel's running out of friends, isn't it?
Actually, our friends need to choose whether they're going to be in the right side of history or in the wrong side of history. There are only two sides in this story. Hamas, who's a jihadi terrorist, want to commit a genocide to the Israeli people on the 7th of October, and a democratic country trying to defend itself. Now, you tell me, which side you need to choose in this war and in this battle?
I think
it's quite easy.
I don't for one minute not support the idea that what happened on the 7th of October was an absolute barbarity, and you know jolly well I've said that from day one. The difficulty is, you know, and I know the BBC have been accused of accepting Hamas propaganda, but it looks like, and I don't know whether you agree with these figures, but something like 50,000 Palestinians have been killed since the 7th of October. It's a lot of people.
Well, first of all, in war, people die. The only question is, who's in charge of the fact that innocent people die in the Gaza war? And the answer is Hamas. They created this infrastructure. We just heard last week that Mohammed Sinwar was killed underground of the European hospital. The taxpayers, the European taxpayers sponsored this so Hamas can build this underground tunnel city and hurt Israeli civilians and kidnap our hostages. You met Emily Damari. You know exactly...
I campaigned for Emily Damari.
But when you get
an Israeli cabinet minister talking about aid going into Gaza, saying not even a grain of wheat should get in, you can see why the international community struggles.
Well, are you quoting now Smotrich?
I am.
Okay, so let me speak about sanctioning our ministers. This is a wrong moral decision of the British government. This will go down history as the first time that a democratic country is sanctioning ministers of another ally, another democratic country. Now, let me quote to you a person that is not supporting Smotrich or Ben-Gvir, is one of the prominent leaders of the opposition in Israel. His name is Benny Gantz. And he said today on Twitter, as a reaction, sanctions on ministers in one and only democratic state in the Middle East, the State of Israel, is a profound moral mistake and sends a dangerous message to the terrorists of Hamas.
So that's Zippy Hotaveli. I don't know how you pronounce it, but she's the genocidalist Israeli ambassador to London, speaking to Nigel Farage there on GB News, where he's got his own programme. It just seems like a bit of light questioning compared to the sort of thing that you'd get even with the BBC. I noticed that the BBC had a particularly damning thing about the Israelis starving everybody in Gaza. Gaza. And by the way, I found it impossible to get through to contacts in Gaza over the last few days because there's been apparently some sort of massive internet outage. God knows what's going on over there.
Well, yes, that's what I've heard. The people in Gaza can't communicate to the outside world at all now. Well, I think this is a bit of a tricky one for Nigel, isn't it? Public opinion in this country is pretty firmly against the Israelis on this.
Now, he was in that little meeting, wasn't he? The birthday party for Israel.
He was in the birthday party with CPU.
With her, Bakkeli, yes.
And also with Maria Eagle from the Labour Party.
I imagine he's been approached by the Israel
Kemi
lobby.
Badenoch.
Just like Cameron, obviously bowed to their pressure or just decided to go along with it because he knows which side his bread is buttered and has got no morals whatsoever, which is why he was Prime Minister and then brought back in as Foreign Secretary under Sunak and Tampon Charlie. But the whole business of Farage, I mean, they will be putting similar pressure on him like they were on Corbyn too.
They will. I mean, but Farage is basically more sympathetic to them than Corbyn, and they will be hoping to just get him on side. Don't forget, he went along to their, you know, celebration of the Israeli independence, which is, of course, that when the Israelis unilaterally, without talking to anybody, declared independence, killed tens of thousands of Palestinians, and seized far more land than anybody was prepared to offer them at that stage, and they got away with it. And they're celebrating it in the British Museum the other week, and it was a secret meeting, but we found out who was in there. Nigel Farage was one of those in there, as was Kemi Badenoch. Now, in actual fact, historically, all of those political parties, including the Labour Party, have been far too subservient to Israeli interests, unlike Jeremy Corbyn, who obviously wasn't. But I think if he
wasn't invited to the party.
No, he wasn't invited to the party. I suppose if he was invited, he wouldn't have come, but they wouldn't have invited him in the first place. But I think we've got an election coming up, a general election coming up in this country in 4 years' time, unless it's a major, you know, gunpowder plot kills loads and loads of Labour MPs. But in 4 years' time, it could very well be that Nigel Farage's position on Israel is going to look rather silly, because most people in Britain, especially younger people, don't agree with what they're doing at all. There's clearly a split between the younger and the older. And of course, if you're in the establishment in this country, you've got to be pro-Israel. Now, if he wants to be prime minister under those conditions, he's got to be pro-Israel. But maybe he won't be elected in those conditions. Younger people ain't going to vote for him.
Just going back for a minute to Netanyahu's appeal to the people of Iran. There's something a little bit creepy about this, isn't it? You're killing people who are of the same faith, and also it doesn't even matter if they're of the same faith. You're in the middle of committing a genocide, and yet you say to a neighbouring state that you have declared is your enemy, that you just, you know, actually I'm your friend. There's something really deeply sinister about this guy. It's like, I don't know if he just reads an AI generated script, or he really thinks that he can genuinely appeal to the hearts and minds of Iranians.
I think what they're hoping is that by banging away at the regime, eventually there'll be some kind of colour revolution. The same illusion they have in Russia. See, all of it was quite deliberate, the killing of Russian people on a train the other day. Quite deliberate. C4 explosive, definitely NATO explosive. Obviously been cleared with the British, because they, you know, the Russians are very clear. They weren't sure whether the Americans were behind it, or that they knew the British were, because they've got their intelligence sources. And of course, the idea is and of course the attack on the Crocus theatre in Moscow, it killed hundreds of people. That was carried out because they hope that people in Russia, if they kill enough civilians, will rise up against Putin. That is not going to happen.
And the same thing
in Iraq. In actual fact, people are rallying around their government saying, whatever it takes, we're going to beat these people.
This sort of nonsense, it's almost like, William Joyce and Lord Haw Haw and the German propaganda machine trying to appeal to the British people to overthrow Churchill in the Second World War. This is all just actually grist to the mill. The British people in those days would have just thought, oh, my God, what a bunch of nutters they are. They're complete loons. But this is somehow, they justify this to themselves. Look, before we also completely disappear from talking about Farage, there was another big announcement this week, which I haven't mentioned yet. Just noticed, I meant to talk about it a bit earlier when we were talking about the spending review. But Farage and I think that the Reform Party are doing such an amazing job in bringing up some subjects which have not been talked about by the Uniparty at all. What about this in Port Talbot last week, or this week, yeah?
Industry in Wales is being destroyed. My last visit to Port Talbot was I did a live TV show here 3 years ago when I predicted, sadly but accurately, that the blast furnaces would go, and they've gone. But it's okay, you'll be told. It's not a problem, because the electric arc will be up and running sometime in 2028. Well, the electric arc is fine for recycling steel. It doesn't produce the kind of virgin steel needed, certainly for military hardware. But the problem with the electric arc is that it is, by its name, using vast amounts of electricity in what is the most expensive industrial electricity energy prices in the world. Tata can say what they like. Frankly, I very much doubt, given the status quo, that furnace will ever, ever be switched on. Our ambition is to reindustrialise Wales. We are going to be using more steel over the next few years than we've probably ever used, as we increase military spending and as we attempt a house building programme in Wales, and even more so in England, of massive proportions, just to catch up with the population explosion over the last 20 years. We are going to need a lot of steel. Our belief is we should be producing our own steel. Our belief is, for what uses coal still has, we should produce our own coal. Boris Johnson pronounced boldly, it's the end of coal. Well done, Boris. This year, on Earth, mankind is going to burn 8 billion tonnes of coal. It's almost hard to get yourself around that figure, isn't it? 8 billion tonnes of coal. As Indonesia, with its 250 coal stations, China, India, etc. So I'm not standing here, and no doubt some will lampoon this, I'm not saying let's open up all the pits. What I am saying is there's coal, specific types of coal for certain uses that we still need in this country, and we certainly will need for the blast furnaces here, that we should produce ourselves rather than importing. And just before Port Talbot closed, they were importing the coal there from Australia.
So there's Nigel Farage, Martin, wants to reopen the blast furnace at Port Talbot and open some more coal mines, or some of the old coal mines, I imagine, in South Wales. There's no one else talking like this, is there?
Well, maybe Arthur Scargill. I'm sure he'll agree with that.
So is Farage a communist?
Well, the point is, if you're going to have a loss-making steel firm and loss-making coal, because it will be loss-making, you're going to have to subsidise it, and it can't be run from the private sector. And, of course, he's in favour of nationalising Thames Water. I agree with him. And, of course, Nigel Farage has got to accept, if he's going to go down this road, that Margaret Thatcher was wrong. Wrong about her policies towards Wales. Now, if Reform want to try and come into this territory, they're going to have to start sticking pins in Margaret Thatcher's eyes, because we're going to be saying to them, so you supported all of this all along. What side were you on in the miners' strike, Nigel? Were you on Arthur's side, or were you on...
Well, I think people will be looking to the future rather than in the 1970s.
Well, the future is that if you want to have... You're not going to be able to restart...
Nigel was quite young in the 1970s.
Yes, I know, but his positions will be clear. He's obviously changed his position. That's okay. There's more joy in heaven about one sinner that repenteth, Tony, than there is about those that carried it, that knew all along. Point is, if we're going to have what he's talking about, we need to raise taxes on wealthy people, nationalise the banks.
This is all true, yes. But don't you think it's interesting that these things do need to be brought up by people whether or not he does it, and I completely agree, he may not do it, but someone has got to bring these things up. In a way, it's very Trump-like, isn't it? So yes. He makes all these promises,
yes.
And oh dear, one by one, he finds that none of them quite working. So maybe Farage is a very similar figure to that, but at least he's bringing them up.
Well, I think that's right. What's more important, rather than individual policies and individual people, is that the era of super free market capitalism, just let the market do it, is definitely over.
Steve Hall.
Finished.
Steve Hall, we spoke to earlier on, the longer interview with him, he talks a lot about all this. Look, this is what you're really going to, if Mr. Farage is serious about this, he needs to do this and this sort of things you
were saying. That's right, but he might find that the people who fund reform, the hedge fund managers and all the rest of it.
Well, actually, might not the be members, the this. Membership. You know how many members they've got?
Quite
in
a
terms
lot.
Of money, they're getting £6 million, over £6 million a year just from their membership.
Yes, but their members are
so they're not
their
absolutely beholden to big, like the Labour Party are, to big donors. See, if the Labour Party were to appeal in a similar way to Reform have done, they could also have their Corbynite 250,000 members all paying into the coffers, yeah, just like Reform have now got.
Yeah, but the thing about the Reform members is they've got no say over the policy. They can. What happened in the, yeah, in
well,
the Corbyn
Tommy
election?
Robinson, Tommy Robinson can join Reform and get nowhere.
Well, he won't be allowed to join Reform because unless Farage changes his mind, he won't be allowed to join.
Anyway, look, before we finish, Martin, we've got to wind up now, but let's go back to a subject we touched on earlier, which is to do with disabled cuts, because I've got a couple of clips from disabled people here. One is called Sally Roberts, and she's a Bristolian disabled woman who describes the situation when she is told that she's having her housing money taken away. She's also been told that she's having her personal independence payments taken away, and she's back down now to universal credit levels, having her benefit levels halved. So she's appealing that, apparently. But this is what they're doing now. They're telling disabled people, Martin, looking them straight in the eyes and saying, you're not disabled.
Well, and of course the special needs budget is well over, it's going to crash in March next year, and loads of local authorities are going to be bankrupt.
Let's hear from Sally.
I went down to the job centre, Temple Street job centre, and I went in, I told them, is this right or wrong, about my £250? They checked the computer, looked down, and said, we already got it planned, you already put £5 in. I said, I'm not paying it. I don't owe you it, so you know what you can do with it. I'm a disabled person, I don't pay rent, and it's on my records. I do not pay rent. I don't know where you got that £250 from. Can you please take it off? No, you will before long, because I will make sure you get people take off me. So I went, sat down in this little quiet area where the computers are, and I started singing, started protesting, started singing like you do. And I'm not leaving until I get my benefits sorted out. I heard somebody else in the conversation with another worker there saying he wasn't entitled to any benefit. He got to go sofa surfing. And I turned around and said, that is fraud to the society. Now you're telling me what to do, you're telling him what to do. He's been assessed and you're telling him he can't get jack for his benefits. So what is society coming to? She didn't answer me. She shut up and laughed at me, thinking I was funny. And then about 5 o'clock, the doors were closed. I said to him, what are you going to do then? You're going to escort me out? The 4 security guards come out. Are you going to escort me out? No, I'm not going to escort out. And then the little squirt, one of their little sitting by people come, said, if you don't leave, we ban you from under in Temple Street. I said, you can't ban me from under in Temple Street. It's the council. You can't ban me. He said, if you don't go out the building now, I will ban you for a temporary. I went, do it. I'm not scared. Do it. And then I turned around and said, ring the police, because if you ring the police will get me. With my mental health, they will detain me and then arrest me at me when they leave the building. So what's the point for me? What's the point? You went, oh, yeah, okay. I can see the logic in it. Then I walked out.
So that's the wonderful Sally Roberts there. But I mean, being told, sorry, you're not disabled. She's actually walking with a stick. She's got all sorts of disabilities that she talks about to me in the longer interview, which is an absolute pleasure to listen. Quite a lot of swearing, I'm afraid. I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later on. This is the coal face, really, Martin, isn't it, of all this economic talk?
Yes, and of course, Rachel Reeves decided to pick on disabled people because she couldn't think of anything else to do. She could have raised taxes on wealthy people.
Because they can't fight back.
Well, they're not prepared to raise taxes on wealthy people.
They haven't got a powerful enough lobby.
No. But what's interesting will be what Reform do about this over the summer, because this is all going to come to Parliament. They have said that they want to end the two-child benefit cap. Got that. They've said that they want to renationalise water. Got that. but they've not said what they're going to do about disabled people and about special needs kids. They're still on the Tory page on that one, because these people are just scroungers, aren't they? Now, if they come out and say these people aren't scroungers, we're going to give them the money, or we'll give them a gold star, and then, of course, we're going to turn around to Nigel and say, where's that money going to come from?
Well, he'll tell you 35 billion is coming from the Bank of England.
Yes,
because
then
we're going to stop them paying. It's not enough, no.
No, it's nothing like enough. It's, as your other contributors were pointing out earlier, he's going in the right direction there, but he's still not making the sums.
Anyway, this attack on disabled people does have a kind of Nazi fascistish whiff to it, doesn't it?
It does, yes. And therefore, it'll be very interesting to see which way Nigel decides to jump.
National Socialist Labour Party.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, let's have a listen now to one of the campaign groups that does campaigns for disabled people. They were in Bristol a few weeks ago. They're called Crips Against Cuts. Again, a little bit of swearing we may have here, I'm afraid.
You're living in a system built on your own suffering. You're in a machine that drains you dry when it can use you and throws you out to rot the second you can't keep up. It's a system that was never built to protect you. It was built to work you, and if you can't, it's going to orchestrate your death. And I'm really tired of pretending otherwise. This government is actively killing cripples. Not accidentally, not through ignorance, deliberately. That's a... We always cheer the government killing people. I'm sorry, I try and do the dark humour, but I'm reckon it might be a bit dark for today. So, you've heard of genocide. Genocide is a word that everybody knows nowadays because of how many genocides are going on across the world. What the UK government is doing to cripples is called a democide. It's what happens when a government intentionally kills its own people. It's death by government policy, not by bullets, not by bombs, by cruelty in a suit, by paperwork soaked up in blood. That's why the Crips are here. I've tried to make that joke so many times and nobody gets it. When the state decides you get to live and who gets to suffer, it's state-sanctioned murder. It's just slower, it's quietly, and it's cowardly. When we think of democides and genocides, we think historically like Stalin starving millions in Ukraine, Hitler's Action T4 program where he killed 300,000 disabled people. We tell ourselves, well, we'd have stood against it. We tell ourselves we would have shouted or fought back. But where the fuck are you? You shopping? You going partying? It's happening again right now. It's happening here. In Britain today, they're not loading us into cattle cars. They're starving us in cold homes. They're cutting our benefits and they're watching us disappear. This is sad again now. Jodie Whiting is dead after her support was stripped away. Errol Graham starved to death. He weighed less than a child when he was found. And it was after the DWP closed his case. Philippa Day collapsed beside a letter that told her life wasn't worth supporting. These aren't tragic accidents. They are intentional. They are executions. I've given you three names. There are 335,000 souls lost to austerity in the last 10 years. If I sat here and told you all of their names, it would take me 6 days without sleep to call them out. And instead, people remain silent on the issues that our community faces. So yeah, the Labour Party isn't wrong, the system is broken. But what they're doing isn't going to fix it. All he's doing is accelerating the death machine. 1.5 million disabled people are stripped of PIP under the Get Britain Working Death Plan. That's more than the population of Birmingham.
Shame!
Yes, thank you for that! Yes. The DWP already knows what comes afterwards. By their own statistics, 61% of claimants experience suicidal thoughts once they're told that they're not worth supporting. That's 900,000 cripples. This government is trying to kill 900,000 people in the name of budget. I'm going to put it really bluntly. Hitler cleared off 300,000 of us. Starmer is about to do three times the damage. I've not even mentioned the right to die bill, but they're also killing us under that.
Well, Well, that person is obviously extremely angry about what's happening.
Crips against cuts. They're doing rallies around the country, yep. Actually. The idea is you get sort of 100, 200, 300, 400 disabled people all there stood around. And some of the disabled people will bring their wheelchairs up to the microphone and say, this is my story.
Yeah.
This is horrific, isn't it? Absolutely horrific.
It is.
Particularly Rachel Reeves and her taking the PIP away, personal independence payments. This is horrible.
Yes, and what she should have done, and what they should have said in their election manifesto, is they're going to raise taxes on wealthy people.
And raise benefits.
And raise benefits, not cut them. Raise it. What also gets me about this in terms of saving money is employers do not want to employ disabled people because it's a fuss. It costs them money, and if we lived in a fairer society, maybe some of them could get some benefit from doing some part-time work. But you'll have to spend more money on them to do that. It's cheaper not to bother. And of course, if you want to try and save money on the back of those people, employers don't want to employ them. So you won't, in fact, save any money. Yeah, you're not saving money. Ultimately, withdrawing money from those people is withdrawing effective demand from the economy. Disabled people on low income spend their money in the shops. They're certainly not saving it.
Well, all the money is going on apparently on a new nuclear power station in Suffolk called Sizewell.
And also on military spending, as Nigel said, in South Wales. We need more military spending. He's keen on that, isn't he?
Well, maybe that might mean jobs if we've got steelworks, mightn't it?
Yes.
I mean, this is something that generally
we don't need steelworks if we're not going to build it.
Boilermakers Union are really cheering about all the money that's going on nuclear. But the money is being taken from disabled people and put into nuclear. By the way, the AI companies we've seen at Bilderberg, the Googles, the Metas, and Microsoft, etc., as well as Amazon, who are regulars at the Bilderberg conferences, they're now, all those four companies are having arrangements to get all their electricity from their own nuclear power stations.
That's right, because they need masses and masses of nuclear
AI.
Of electricity. The interesting thing about the decision by Miliband to go ahead with Sizewell C, and he's going to spend $14 billion on it, but of course that won't be anything like enough. If it was viable, the private sector would do it, wouldn't it? So if it's not viable, the state has to step in. And of course, if we do go into a recession stroke depression now, the only way to get the economy moving the state will have to do it. So all this stuff about the free market that everybody's been going on about since 1979 turns out to have been wrong.
Well,
wrong.
NATO,
we don't need any more free
there's
market.
There's also a NATO,
too late.
NATO summit taking place next week in the Netherlands, which of course is the Bilderberg is like the preamble for all of that. And that's between the 24th and the 25th of June. There will be protests there. So I'll put a link up to the protest website, which I think it says, it's difficult to read the Dutch, but it says Volker en Vorve. Oh, God, look, I can't pronounce this. I'll spell it V-O-L-K-E-R E-N-V. ORVRED.NL. Look, come on, you Dutch, you speak English. Can't you come up with an easier anti-NATO website, for God's sake? But this is what Bilderberg is about, isn't it? You've got the European-American war machine, all the sitting there, the deep state, with someone not called Trump shouting from the sidelines somewhere. And actually, these are the people meeting right now in Stockholm that are putting together the PR and the spin and some of the personnel to make it all happen.
Well, Mark Rutte, who's the head of NATO officially, he's basically saying we've got to give up on the welfare state because we're going to have to spend whatever money we've got on weaponry to fight the Russians and also to help the Israelis out, of course. Because all what's been happening now, last night, that some of these missiles that are being fired towards Iran, towards Israel, have been shot down by RAF planes from Akrotiri. And I tell you what, Nigel, we could save a load of money by closing British bases around the world. There's billions of pounds we're spending on that. Maybe we should spend it all on
our own
people. Akrotiri
is a very useful place to go and drop aid into Gaza and also to maybe destroy genocidalists.
It was very good for attacking Libya and Serbia. We went to war with Serbia for doing far. We were talking about the Srebrenica massacre last week, which everybody, including Keir Starmer, called genocide. But they only killed a couple of 7,000 males of military age. Now, I think that we could use Akrotiri to put in a no-fly zone over Gaza. Maybe we should be knocking out the Israeli air defence,
you know,
like we did in Syria and in Serbia and in Libya. Or maybe we should just come home and mind our own business.
Talking about Africa, do you know anything about the president of Burkina Faso?
Yes, I was talking about him earlier, Traoré, who is a... well, he's come to power through a military coup, as Thomas Sankara did in the 1980s.
Well, like Farage, yeah.
Well, no, Farage is a...
it's not a democratic party.
He's not a military man, though, is he?
But anyway, let's have a little listen to him.
Hunger, war, disease, corruption, terror, chaos. These are the words that come to mind when Africa is mentioned. In your Africa dictionary, there are no other words. No hope, no success, no development, no resistance, no honor, no pride, no victory. So I ask you, New York Times, Washington Post, Guardian, Le Monde, have you ever made Africa's successes your headlines? How many times have you written about Rwanda's technology miracle? How many times have you shown Ethiopia's reforestation project? How many times have you praised Botswana's democratic success? How many times have you described Kenya's entrepreneurial ecosystem? No, because these don't fit your scenario. Your Africa cannot be successful. It cannot, because then how will you legitimize your exploitation? If it's not in need of help, how will you intervene? If it's not backward, how will you look down on it? Have you ever asked yourselves, has any editor sitting at their desk, any news director in a meeting, any columnist at their keyboard ever thought, why are the people of the world's richest lands poor? Here are the numbers for you, real numbers. Africa owns 70% of the world's cobalt reserves. Your cell phone, your computer, your electric car won't work without cobalt. This cobalt comes from Congo, but Congolese can't afford cell phones. Africa owns 90% of the world's platinum reserves. Catalytic converters, electronic devices, medical implants, they all need platinum. This platinum comes from South Africa, but South Africans are crushed by unemployment. Africa provides 30% of the world's gold production. Mali, Burkina Faso, Ghana, Tanzania. Gold flows like rivers from our lands. But our people swim in poverty. Africa supplies 65% of the world's diamond production. Botswana, Angola, Congo, Sierra Leone, billions of dollars worth of diamonds are extracted. But our miners live on $1 a day. Africa owns 35% of the world's uranium reserves. Niger, Namibia, South Africa. Nuclear plants run on our uranium. Paris lights burn with our uranium. But our villages have no electricity. And you still ask, why is Africa poor? No, the right question is, how was Africa kept poor while being so rich? Here's your answer. Colonialism didn't end. It changed shape. You used to come and occupy our lands. Now you come and establish companies. You used to take by force. Now you make agreements. You used to rule with the whip. Now you rule with credit.
So that's the Burkina Faso fighting back. Is it a good thing this guy's taken over in a military coup then?
Well, he's been regarded... I mean, he obviously went to the May the 9th parade in Moscow to remember the victory in World War II. He's very much seen as a leader of third world opinion.
Isn't Africa turning to Russia and China?
That's right. That's right. That's what's happening. Because the Western powers have played their hand. And, of course, the Israelis aren't helping that.
Meanwhile, in China...
Do you really know how powerful China is? In just the past year, China has completely reshaped global expectations, militarily, technologically, and geopolitically. And nobody saw it coming. Take this. In the India-Pakistan conflict, Pakistan used China's J-10 CE fighters, which the West mocked as inferior, and shot down 6 Indian jets, including 3 Rafales. Clean sweep. Then came the moon. June 2024, Chang'e 6 landed on the far side and returned with nearly 2 kilos of lunar soil. NASA asked for a share. China said no. A few months later, China launched an intercontinental missile 12,000 kilometers into the Pacific. A record. The world was stunned. At the Zhuhai Air Show, China showed off tech no one expected. AI jets, robotic wolf packs, hypersonic missiles, stealth drones, unmanned warfare. China's now light years ahead. They even built the world's first working oblique detonation engine, hitting Mach 16 or 20,000 kilometers per hour. That's a Beijing-LA flight in 20 minutes. And the US predicted this would change warfare forever. If anyone could build it, China did. And energy? China now leads the world in nuclear reactors, 102 and counting. Their artificial sun fusion project is almost ready. If it works, we're talking about unlimited clean energy, a sci-fi future made real. Now, if you've followed this far, even the most skeptical mind should realize one thing. China's power isn't about showing off. It's about focus, patience, and peace. Just because we don't make noise doesn't mean we're weak. And whether the world accepts it or not, China is rising to the very top again, and nothing can stop it.
Well, I don't know who that was or who, what website it came from, but it's...
TikTok, mate. TikTok.
Okay, well, I mean, I read a lot about what's going on in China, and of course they are, you know, they're defeating the West by just being better at capitalism than they
Something's going on,
isn't it? Because they understand it better than the West
does. The idea is that democracy is a waste of time. Don't even expect... Just have... Live in a country where the leaders are... They're not interested in what you think or what you say, but they're just good at what they do.
Well, I think the Chinese would dispute that. They'd say that we do have a democratic system. People, we do consult with people, but it's not the same as yours. Saudi Arabia is our big ally in the Middle East.
Actually, Gaddafi was
Gaddafi
was a good example of someone that set up a system for policy under him, but he wasn't moving.
Well, that's
and
right.
It worked really well, actually.
Well, I mean, the point is that... What Putin is saying and what Xi is saying is we're not trying to tell everybody else what to do. All different countries have got different histories. They're going to have different solutions to their problems. And we should just basically respect the internal struggles with it. I mean, you know, China becomes more prosperous and people become more, you know, they travel the world, for example. The Chinese middle class are the biggest tourists on earth now. Previously, they couldn't leave the country. And if they did leave the country, they say, it's so oppressive over there. Can we come and stay in the United States? Oh, yes, yes, come along. The people who fled from Tiananmen Square, they're all welcomed into the United States. But the Chinese middle class go all over the world now, and they go home.
Outside our door here, actually. There's a whole massive student block full of Chinese students.
That's right.
Because their pockets are bulging with cash.
Well, that's right. And, of course, they go home to China because that's where they come from, and that's where they're...
So who decided the great industrial power of the world would move from Britain and America to China?
It was a decision of the financialization of the Big Bang in this country, and of course what happened in the US was similar.
Britain's industry was declining well before the 1980s.
The financialization, they've been moving in that direction. You see, the financialization means that we have just become... We're not pen pushers, because it's not pens anymore, it's computers. We thought the idea is that you can move into service industries which don't require physical output. Whereas the Chinese think, the Chinese are now... Their economists are developing what they call socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Yeah, but back in the 1970s, we had plenty of cash to look after. And in fact, what many of the people today have been saying, including you, I think, is that we still could have the cash to look after disabled people. This idea that because the economy is not competing with China and we're going down the tubes with massive overheads on everything, that we're going to have to let the disabled people die. We're very sorry. It's actually a lie.
It's wrong because, of course, we are still wealthier per head by a long way than China. Anyway, and we've got plenty of resources. We just want to waste them on trying to stop the Chinese being successful rather than looking after our own people.
Schadenfreude, rather nasty little people, isn't it, that think like that. So finally, we're going to leave it tonight looking at the nuclear deterrent of Israel, as they say, the nuclear so-called bombs. They don't like admitting that they've got these nuclear weapons, Martin, do they?
Well, if they admitted it, they would immediately come under
the Logan Act,
and there would be automatic sanctions.
But they have admitted it, actually, but nothing seems to have happened.
That doesn't
anyway,
matter, does it?
Todd Ryder, him, the US researcher and scientist, ex of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has come up with another one of his wonderful films about the Germans inventing nuclear weapons and testing nuclear weapons in 1944, before the beginning of the war. So when the Israelis want to fire one of their nukes out of a submarine, they can remember that this is a technology invented by Hitler.
Let's move on to sub-launch ballistic missiles, not cruise missiles. And here were launches as early as 1942 of rockets from a submarine that was underwater. So this almost looks like the modern launch of a Polaris Trident missile or something. But this was a smaller missile launched from a submarine underwater in 1942. This was done in collaboration with engineers from Peenemünde, the rocket base. And once they had demonstrated this with small rockets, they started doing it with larger and larger rockets. There was enough Allied surveillance and bombing on the Baltic coast that they switched over to Austria a large lake in the middle of nowhere in Austria. And they were building larger and larger sub-launch missiles and testing, demonstrating them in Austria. Then the ultimate would be if you could deliver a sub-launch V2 or A4 rocket, a very large rocket with a fairly large payload. Now, that type of rocket is too large to fit into any of the wartime submarines that they had. So they developed a solution. A German submarine would tow a submarine trailer, and this trailer would initially be horizontal, be towed across the Atlantic, and the trailer would contain one of these V2 or A4 rockets. And then once they got off the coast of their target, they would flood one end of this trailer, that end would sink. Now the rocket would be upright, they'd open the doors and launch it. If you read the history books, officially this was purely a paper design, never got anywhere, never seriously contemplated. But here is documentation from one of the modern German U-boat museums saying that, oh yeah, during the war in 1944, they actually built these things. And they were successfully doing trials to see how well a submarine could tow these things. So it was actually built. Here is additional evidence. This is from the French, who were also investigating German technologies after the war. So a French investigator after the war wrote about some of his discoveries, what the Germans had been doing during the war, including a submarine capable of launching V2s. It was actually built. And that the Germans planned to use that to get off the coast and to bomb American cities, including Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Charleston. And that they planned to do this with atomic bombs. These amphibious V2s would carry atomic bombs. They planned to do this in conjunction with launching rockets from Europe at the United States. And according to this French investigator, Germany would have done this beginning in June 1945, if the war had not ended just when it did.
So that's Dr. Todd Ryder. Quite an amazing discovery coming across his stuff, because it is hidden. It's called Hidden Histories, the channel, but there's almost nothing in the metadata or the headline of the video in order to where you wouldn't find it unless you knew. So I will put the link to that full interview there up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. We really do have to download the MP4, video file, because all of the evidence, the documents, etc., are there up on the screen for you to see. From, for example, the document from the German Submarine Museum that shows that these things were not just a paper design, Martin. They were really tested in World War II. The Nazis were way ahead on this. And really, all the Manhattan Project were doing was sticking a new label on the Nazi technology for the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima and on Nagasaki.
So, in other words, your thesis that elements within the Nazi regime had done an underground deal with the Western powers at Bilderberg, or rather, as a result of what happened at Arnhem, and of course Bilderberg was at Oosterbeke, which is where the Polish paratroops were surrounded.
That was Arnhem,
the Kessel for them. It starts to put a different pattern of the whole of history, doesn't it? And of course, they were then planning to attack the Soviet Union with these nuclear weapons. They didn't do it. And Klaus Fuchs, who was based here and also part of the Manhattan Project, he was a refugee from Nazi Germany. He'd left in 1933. And he was a physicist. He worked on all of this stuff. And he was the one, or him and others, who made sure that the Soviets had access to all of this material so they could produce their own bomb, and that would settle things down. Maybe we wouldn't be facing this problem now if Iran had a nuclear bomb. They wouldn't dare to do what they're doing. We could give our nuclear bombs to Iran because we don't need
maybe,
them.
Well, maybe the Iranians do have nuclear
bombs. Well, if they had them, they'd have
said
so.
As you and I know, in the 1990s, it was possible to buy Russian nuclear weapons on the black market. Right. Roger Cook proved that you could get weapons-grade plutonium. Not only that, an SS-20 was offered.
Yes, okay.
And they lifted up the tarpaulin on it, and there it was. Yeah, we can do a deal. You can buy one of these.
Yes, well, the Iranians have always had the capability of producing nuclear weapons. They decided not to. Inside the Iranian elite, there are now people going to be saying, that was foolish of us. Yeah. Because if we developed a nuclear bomb, they wouldn't be talking to us like this. They'd be much more polite.
They say that mutually assured destruction kept the peace right the way through the Cold War,
That's right, but it's only when we've got the weaponry. See, if other people... see, because we don't threaten people. The Americans have threatened several times to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states. They threatened the North Koreans, and they threatened the North Vietnamese.
Yeah, and it's becoming increasingly clear that Ukraine is Israel. They're both basically...
Well, they're all part of the Western system, aren't they?
...is Bilderberg. So no wonder Peter Thiel was, looking a little bit down, a little bit kind of troubled. So, Ode, Bilderberg Syndrome, 71 Trilateral Street, from Patricia, her poem this week, Old Goats of Bloat, Big Shots, All Who, Think They Rule Our Lives, 'Tis True, On Private Jets, Two Fingers See, To CO2, Climate, Teehee, A Shindig Every Year We'll Meet, In Limo's Black, Trilateral Fleet, Bilderbergers, Actus Reus, Actus Reus, a gilded cage of fat cat players, an evil cult knee, Zionism, pray one day each will end in prison. Wallenbergs, Thiel, Schmidt and Co., Mentes Riu, come to know, each year they push and shove and hope, what they say may be of note. No room for God or faith, the clue, but steal and cheat and wars can do. A tawdry world, playground of hell, Bilderberg, a cult, a spell. Attendees see at altar kneel. With Bilderberg, perhaps they feel untouchable, omnipotent, as lives destroy and circumvent. Such wealth and power, a heady spell, each psychopath we now know well. A hierarchy, a bad boys club, with ease to squeeze, damnation rub. Palantir, our currencies, jabs, AI, security. World War III, fake revelations, divvy up the world and nations. Syndrome, Stockholm, Temptation Street, where ne'er-do-wells this year we'll meet. Puppet play, changes afoot. United Nations now, kaput. Carp, Barroso, steer to order. Enslaving lives to new world order. A one-world government to span, hand-in-hand with Satan's plan. Thank you so much, Patricia, again, once more. Particularly apposite there. So that's all we have time for this week. And if you want to follow the Bilderberg stuff, the Bilderberg channel is... the Telegram channel is Bilderberg 25. That's the one I've given people their permission, but there's also quite a lot on Twitter. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, plus all of our studio sort of pre-recorded guests this week, Sally Roberts particularly, also of course to Steve Hall. Fascinating half an hour with him this week as a reaction to the spending review, pulling it all to pieces. Also of course to Chris Williamson from the Workers' Party too. And so also of course thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can, and to of course Anna Borno, almost forgot. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram too. Please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel and via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, which includes the podcast, full length interviews, story links and a comment page. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter, and if you can afford it, please donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk, and you can do that either on the PayPal, which is Peter Thiel's creation, or else just the normal kind of bank account system. So my book, my paperback, firstly, is about the deals between Churchill and the Nazis at the end of World War II. Martin was just talking about there. It's called The Traitors of Arnhem. One of the most important things was the Red House meeting in the August before the Battle of Arnhem, where much of this was sorted out. And who knows, maybe, as Martin was suggesting, much of the nuclear agreements were made. And maybe there was some secret spy from the Americans are over there too, and the Brits, who knows. But Martin the book is The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers. That costs £15 for an actual book, and this show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. That's when I get it right, which I don't always do, but do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live from Bristol on the stream, the talkradio.org.uk stream, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable Bilderberg weekend. Because like the Templars, they're on a hiding to nothing. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
side. That's why I'll praise His holy, holy, holy name. He's really been wonderful. Oh, yes, He has. Wonderful. Oh yes, He is. I'm wondering tonight, is there anybody else who knows? No, 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 that the Lord is wonderful. He's wonderful. I'm a living witness tonight that He's really been wonderful.
And this moment keeps slipping away. I get so tired working so hard for our survival. I look to the time of you to keep me awake and alive. And all my and the grand facade so soon will burn.